I'm going to call to order this joint meeting of the Local Government and Metropolitan Affairs and Committee and the Energy Finance and Policy Division. We organized this joint hearing because I think that what we will hear from our testifiers, who I'll introduce in a moment, is something that is vitally relevant to the considerations of both committees. And just let me say by way of preface here that I think it has occurred to many of us who are not economists that we live on a finite planet with finite resources. And we're kind of experiencing this conjunction of two implications of that. One is that we're beginning to realize that some of the resources upon which we depend are beginning to appear to be in short supply. And also, we're beginning to realize that another resource that on which we depend, which is the Earth's capacity to absorb all of the nasty things that we dump into it, is also reaching a point at which it's perhaps no longer able to do that. Of course, what we're talking about is, on the one hand, global warming and climate change and the implications of that, and on the other, the availability of the fossil fuels and the cheap energy on which our global economy depends. As I said in advertising this meeting, there have been numerous warnings about this situation, and some people have actually taken that to heart and attempted to confront the situation head on, and I feel really privileged to have two of those people here with us today. Mr. John Kaufman, who's a senior policy analyst for the Oregon Department of Energy, and who recently was essential staff to the Portland Peak Oil Task Force, and he will be explaining what the city of Portland has done in trying to confront these issues. And with him at the table is Mr. Daniel Lurch, program director, program manager for the Post Carbon Institute, and author of a book that I highly recommend called Post Carbon Cities, and he'll be describing that a little bit later. And we're going to have kind of a tag team here, which I asked Mr. Kaufman to begin the presentation with a kind of a brief primer or overview of the peak oil situation, since I think it's something that to many of our members will be somewhat less familiar than it should be. And I'm kind of leaving it to these gentlemen who work well together to move back and forth in the presentation as they see fit. So with that, Mr. Kaufman, if you would, we'd like you to go ahead with your presentation. And let me say just one more thing, which is that if you could hold questions that you have, these will basically be in three parts, and we'll pause for questions at the end of each segment. But we would rather not interrupt the presentation with questions. So, Mr. Kaufman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Hilty. Thank you, members of the committee. I'm glad to be here. Cold weather and all. I am a native Wisconsin boy, so I am used to it, and nice to come back to it.
And Mr. Kaufman, one thing that I neglected to mention is if you would identify yourself for the record so we have it on tape and we can tell who's talking.
Being a state employee, I should have remembered that. My name is John Kaufman. I'm senior policy analyst for the Oregon Department of Energy, in Salem, located in Salem, Oregon. I welcome the opportunity to be here and talk. to try to walk you through some of the issues that we faced in Portland. Peak oil is an acronym, or not an acronym, it's a, you know, a colloquialism for a phenomenon that is happening, a physical phenomenon that is happening around the world. I will use the term peak oil. I know that gives some people some concern in terms of what it implies, but there is some solid evidence behind it that I hope to walk you through here this afternoon. Peak oil, again, I'm using it as shorthand for what it really implies. Peak oil is probably the biggest problem you've never heard about at this point. Global warming, I think people are well aware of. That was popularized, of course, you know, with Al Gore's movie, The Inconvenient Truth, and has been growing in awareness for 10 or 15 years, kind of highlighted by that, as well as other recent developments. Peak oil has not had quite the same level of prominence yet. So what is peak oil? I want to walk through a little bit. Of course, you know, everyone's aware oil and gas prices have been climbing in the last several years. They have crude oil prices have gone up 3.5 or 4-fold in the last 5 or 6 years, and consumer prices at the pump have almost tripled. And still, even at that, we are only at inflation-adjusted, you know, levels of 1979. So what's causing the price increases? Well, the price increases are caused, really, fundamentally by supply and demand. So I'm going to try to cover real briefly some of the demand issues and turn to the supply issues. Demand is really being driven by two sources right now. Number one is the growth of energy use, in particular oil, in some of the underdeveloped countries, and in particular China, which holds, you know, 1/5 of the world's population. India has also seen rapid growth, so getting demand from that side. But we can't leave out the United States. You know, growth continues to rise here at 1.5% per year. We are the largest consumer of oil. We use 25% of the oil in the world, and they're continuing to grow. And we have more people driving more miles in more efficient, in less efficient vehicles. The actual CAFE mileage standards actually have been dropping in recent years. What about supply? Okay, so we got growing demand. What about the supply side? Well, there's two issues with supply. There's short-term supply, and there's long-term supply. I'm going to deal real briefly with the short-term supply and then turn to the long. Short-term supply is issues like Hurricane Katrina shuts down. You get a shortfall of oil coming from the Gulf Coast. Refinery capacity. Wars going on around the world. Other geopolitical jitters. What's going on in Iraq or in Iran? Things like that. Thing is, there are always short-term supply problems going on. Always. So it's not like, well, when we get past this set of short-term supply things, that things are going to go back to normal. You can have other short-term supply problems that are going to jump right in and continue the problem. So if you've got growing demand and continuing short-term problems, where is the real, you know, where is the imbalance coming from? Well, the imbalance, we feel, is coming from long-term supply problems. You know, chronic problems, we are bumping. That's where we get to the point of peak oil. We are starting to bump up against the fact that we are reaching the peak of oil production. Does peak oil mean we're running out of oil? Well, yes and no. It doesn't mean we're, you know, going to run out of oil tomorrow. But it does mean we're reaching the point of maximum production. The world will not be able to produce any more oil. We are producing as much per day as we can produce. And it will reach a plateau, level off, and start to decline. And I'll go through some of the evidence, whether it's happened already, whether it will happen soon, whether it will happen in some far distant future. But the fundamental thing is it's leveling off and it outstrips your demand. Where you get the gap there between the supply and demand is where the price increases start to happen. When supply can no longer match demand, you get price increases. Here's what's happened to global oil production in the last 5 years. You can see that it is definitely reaching a plateau. It is flattening off. So what's some of the evidence for peak oil? What is some of the indications? Well, one of the big indicators is discoveries. World discoveries of oil peaked in the 1960s. 1964, to be exact. They have been declining since then. We know that production follows discovery. You can't produce what you haven't discovered. And at some point, if production has peaked, if discovery has peaked, production must follow. It will peak as well. How long does that take? probably 25 to 40 years, and that is observed from a number of countries around the world that have already reached peak of production. It has typically occurred within the 25 to 40 year time period after their discoveries have peaked. For example, in the United States, discoveries peaked in the 1930s with some of the discoveries in Texas, and production peaked in 1971, precipitated some of the energy crises and the price increases that we saw in the 1970s. It was a 40-year lag time. What other indicators do we have? Well, discoveries peaked in the 1960s, and production has started to exceed discoveries in 1983 and has continued to do so every year since, and in fact is growing. The red there is the gap between how much we use each year and how much we discover. In fact, for every barrel of oil that we find these days, we are using six. That obviously is an unsustainable situation that will not continue to last for a very long period of time. Two-thirds of the oil-producing nations in the world have already peaked in their production, including several large countries such as the United States, Russia, Iran, Venezuela, and I could probably list the number of others that just comes off the top of my mind. In addition to two-thirds of the world's oil-producing countries having peaked, two of the world's five largest fields have peaked. And there is significant evidence or indication that the largest field in Saudi Arabia, which accounts for about 8% of the world's oil production from one field, has perhaps peaked. And I think you'll probably be hearing more about that from a speaker who will be coming in a couple of weeks, Matthew Simmons. In addition, we have exports will probably peak before production peaks, meaning that it will be difficult for us to find additional supplies. And the reason for this is because oil exporting nations, well, they use oil too, and they have growing populations, and they are industrializing, and they use more oil. And so as they reach the peak of production and they have increasing demands internally, where will that oil go? That oil will go and be used for internal uses. They will have less available for export. If they have less available for export, we have less available for import. So the peak may actually occur before the physical peak of production. We may start to see some of the problems experienced economically here. There's very little spare productive capacity in the world oil supply system anymore. As you see here from the graph, in the 1980s, the world had the capability to produce 25% more oil than it needed. Now you're down in about the 2 to 3 to 4% range. So that means, if you go back to the short-term supply problems that I talked about earlier, you get a short-term problem, something happens, Hurricane Katrina goes out, where are you going to turn for, you know, to make up that shortfall? There's no place that can come in and step in and step up supply quickly anymore. We are reaching the point of no surplus capacity left. So how much oil do we have left? There are three approaches to estimate how, you know, when the peak will occur, how much oil we have left. There is a trend analysis, which uses historical data and applies statistical techniques to it. There is a physical approach, and I call that the top-down approach. There's a bottom-up approach, which is a geologic approach where you have the geologist, petroleum geologist, sitting there and looking at field by field by field across the world and saying which ones are peaking, which ones are not, what's their rate of decline, and they come up with estimates. The third approach is the economic approach where it is simply, you know, you assume that production will respond to price signals. And that is the one that yields the optimistic scenarios, as opposed to the first two, which yields results indicating peak oil happening very soon. The top-down analysis was developed by a petroleum geologist for Shell Oil back in 1956. He predicted that the United States would peak in 1970, and that is exactly when it happened. And he used techniques such as this. He predicted, as you see from this slide, he predicted there would be about a little over 2 trillion barrels of oil in the world. Using his method to the U.S. production, the red line indicates his prediction and the dots indicate what actually happened in the United States with production. As I say, using his methodology, he estimated there'd be about 2 or 2.2 trillion barrels of oil in the world to be produced. Another way of doing it, you know, we have done this in our office. We've had some people look at this, is you look at the actual discoveries, which are the blue bars there, and they form a geometric shape called a triangle. And if you take one half of height times width, you can calculate the area under the triangle, and it yields a result of approximately 2 to 2.5 trillion barrels. That is about how much oil that the world has. If you follow that trend of discoveries down, we will have found about 2 to 2.5 trillion barrels of oil in the world. You aren't going to use more than that. We have already used 1.1 trillion, which is represented by the red line. Bottom-up analysis, like I say, is a field-by-field analysis. You look at the fields, individual fields peak. You combine individual fields into nations, they peak. At some point, when enough nations in the world have peaked in their production, the world will be said to have peaked. You take the production, you take your current production, you subtract out your production declines, you add in new fields and any advanced recovery techniques. And showing techniques like that, there's a gentleman, a petroleum geologist from Britain, that says that we will peak probably by about 2011, give or take a year or two. So again, the bottom up and top-down analysis show that we are at or near the peak. Third approach, of course, is the economic approach. It assumes that production and technology will respond to price. Higher prices will stimulate more drilling, we will find more oil, and everything's going to be easy sailing. It yields, of course, most optimistic estimates, but even they say that the peak will happen maybe by 2030. Well, that's only 20-some years ago. Oh, wait, 25 years away. The optimistic estimates, you know, where people say instead of 2 to 2.5 trillion barrels of oil, we might have 3 or 4 trillion barrels of oil, which are represented by the green and blue arrows there, would indicate that this is what would have to happen to discoveries. The trend is clearly on the downswing. We would absolutely have to reverse our discoveries in order to postpone the peak, as you will have it. We think that that's unlikely. We know more than ever about where oil is found. People say, well, you know, in the 1970s, you know, the United States peaked. Well, what about Saudi Arabia? We found, you know, we found oil in other places. Yes, we did. At that point, we hadn't drilled a lot around the world. At this point, we have drilled millions and millions of wells around the world. We have geographic mapping techniques. We have seismic mapping techniques. We know the conditions under which oil was found. We know where to look, and we have drilled holes there. We are not in. And the other thing is, you're going to find the large deposits first. Saudi Arabia's, the United States, the Irans, the Iraqs, those are the ones you find first. If I were to take a handful of marbles here and roll them across the room, which ones would you find? Well, you'd find the ones right out there in the middle, real easily. You just sweep them in. Hey, this is, you know, easy sailing. Then you'd have to start looking under the chairs and into the corners, and you'd be pulling out one and two at a time. That's what it is. That's what it's like with with the oil wells, you know, with the oil drilling and discoveries. We are not likely to find some huge field. We are not going to find another Saudi Arabia. We would have to, what's the statistic manual? We would have to find a Saudi Arabia every 4 years. We'd have to find a Saudi Arabia every 4 years, something equivalent to that, in order to offset the expected declines that are going to happen in the next few years. Again, it's unlikely. Drilling has gone up. You can see the trends in drilling have gone up in the last several years in the graph on the left, and production continues to go down. There, can we? People say, well, we're recovering more from the oil fields. We can have technology improvement. Well, that's already factored into some of the projections in terms of how much oil is available in the world and how much we can produce. They've already considered that in those analyses they've done. And they may yield a little bit more. Some of the advanced technology techniques at this point have allowed us to pull about 10% more oil out of some of the fields. You know, the 10% is not enough to offset some of the declines that we are looking at. They talk about unconventional oil, the oil sands in Canada, oil shale in the Rockies. Again, they are such, those could potentially be huge resources, but here we come down to a question of what is the flow rate? How much can you produce? It is so extensive and so environmentally detrimental and so difficult to do that it won't scale. I guess that's probably the word I'm searching for. They won't scale. You will not produce, even if there is a trillion barrels in some of the oil sands, it will not be able to increase the production at the level that we're getting from the oil wells, where you simply tap something in the ground and it literally, you know, under its own pressure comes to the surface. You know, we may have 1,000 years of oil in the oil sands, but we're going to be producing them at about 3 million barrels a day, which is about 1/20th of how much oil we use. New discoveries are smaller and they don't reverse the trend. You know, any discoveries we find these days tend to get smaller and smaller and are in more remote areas of the world and harder to get at. The oil sands, offshore oil, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. You know, that's where we have to go for oil, and there's smaller deposits. Even if we found more, what would it do to the peak? If we got up to 3 trillion barrels of oil, it would offset the peak, delay the peak by about 5 to 7 years. That's how much oil we use. So when will oil production peak? Well, there's a range of estimates. In the yellow, colors show up not real well. In the yellow, about halfway through there, you have a number of people saying within the next 5 years. You have another group that say probably happen within the next 10 years. And then you have a few that say it's, you know, 10, 20, 25 years off in the future. What characterizes the difference there is in the first two groups in the 5 to 10 year period there is mostly petroleum geologists and bankers, people who are putting their money on the line. It is the economists and some of the oil companies that have the estimates that take the odds to 2030 and 2040. And the reason the oil companies are there, why do you suppose the oil companies have high estimates? It's a simple fact. If they came out and literally said, we're nearing peak oil, their stocks would tank. It is not in their interest to stand up and warn us. We'll skip through that. I don't want to ignore natural gas, be very brief on dealing with natural gas, and just say that it is a fossil fuel. Very often associated with oil production, it is also found in some cases on its own, and it is on the same trajectory as oil. It will peak. The projections are it will probably peak some years later than oil, but we don't get as much energy from natural gas as we do from oil, so the combined effect is still the same. The combined peak still happens. It does not delay the peak of fossil fuel use. Peak will still be somewhere in the next 5 to 10 years. The United States is already in decline in natural gas production. We have been in decline for a number of years. Location of natural gas. Canada, I believe, is plateaued or possibly peaked, and Mexico has as well. So we are not going to increase production of natural gas in North America. So where are we going to have to turn to get natural gas? We would have to import it from overseas, which means you have to load it in tankers, and the two biggest suppliers of natural gas are Russia and Iran, not exactly our best friends. We would have to load it into tankers, ship it across the ocean, liquefy it to temperatures of minus 250 degrees, a very expensive proposition to do so. Natural gas, if we are lucky, I think we will maintain our current level of natural gas for some years. I do not think we are going to increase our level of natural gas. We need to face that fact very soon. Energy mix in the United States, what does it mean? Well, I guess what I'm coming to, what does it mean? Oil and natural gas together account for 2/3 of the energy we use in this country. It is equivalent to the flow of the Santa Am River in Oregon. I'm told that it's equivalent roughly to the flow of the Mississippi River going through St. Cloud. That's how much oil the world uses. Imagine that river is oil, and you were pumping it dry at St. Cloud, so nothing gets past St. Cloud. You're just loading it onto trucks 24/7, 365 days a year. That's how much oil the world uses. It's a lot. It is a prodigious amount of oil. Oil affects everything. It affects everything we do. It is used not just for transportation, for driving our cars. It's fundamental to the economy. We make things with oil and natural gas. We grow food with oil and natural gas. Fertilizer is made from natural gas and oil, pesticides are made from oil. Without them, production would drop 50% or more. And we have public and social services. Why oil matters? Vice President Cheney said it very well in 1999. Oil is unique in that it is so strategic in nature. We are not talking about soap flakes or leisure wear here. This is a critical world resource. The world economy operates on oil and natural gas. When they start to go into decline, we have some problems we are going to need to deal with. And we should start thinking about those problems now. Oil does an immense amount of work for us. Imagine pulling these vehicles. Something that with 1 gallon of gas can go 20 miles within a few minutes would take weeks of several people pulling to get it there. It packs tremendous power. Some of these things we would not be able to do without oil. You're not going to fly airplanes without oil. Even nuclear power. I mean, getting nuclear power potentially would have the power, but with the lead shielding that's required, you wouldn't get the airplane off the ground. There is no substitute for oil and gas in some uses. And oil is used as feedstock. Oil and gas are used as feedstock for a number of products. I'm going to skip through, in the interest of time, I'm going to skip through some of the slides on the energy return on energy invested, jump right to some of the alternatives. What can we do for some of the alternatives? Big thing I want to convey before I get started, I'm going to come back to this at the end, but the big thing I want to convey is there is no magic bullet. There is no energy source out there that is as powerful as oil and gas, or is available and in the quantity that we have had oil and gas. There is no resource or combination of resources that are going to substitute for oil and gas and let us continue to go on the way we have been going on. We are going to have to face changes in the way we do things. What about coal? Well, first of all, we have the issue of global warming. Do we really want to go down that avenue? But even if we do, we have the issue that coal is a fossil resource. It will peak. I have seen very varied estimates as to when we will peak. Some say we have 250 years worth. Other people say, well, that's not much. We have 100 years worth. You know, if you really project through how much was used, it's only about 100 years worth. But even if you say we have 80, 90, or 100 years of coal left, if we start to increase the use of coal to offset oil and natural gas, it will peak in the next 20 or 25 years. It is not a long-term solution, and we've got the added problem of global warming. Nuclear is essentially facing the same situation. If we wanted to turn to nuclear power, well, number one, we would have to increase our use of nuclear power tenfold in order to offset oil and natural gas in the long term. And if we started to use nuclear at that rate, we would run out of uranium in 10 to 20 years. Same thing. We're facing the peaking problem. These are non-renewable resources. We need to start to adjust to the fact that we are using non-renewable resources. We need to start to do things differently. Oil sands, oil shales, I talked about a little briefly, and very polluting. I'm not sure we want to go down that avenue either. What about hydrogen? Well, hydrogen is what's called an energy carrier. It's not an energy resource in and of itself. You don't go somewhere, drill a hole, and find hydrogen. You have to produce hydrogen from something else. Well, where do we get hydrogen? Right now, we get hydrogen from oil and natural gas. We have to use energy to take the hydrogen out of oil and natural gas. We use energy in doing it. So where else could you get it? Well, in the long term, you could produce hydrogen from water using renewable resources. But again, it is a big energy loser. It costs more energy to produce that hydrogen than you get out of the hydrogen. Not a very economical thing to do. We may have to do it for some uses, you know, but we probably won't do it for transportation. We will probably be better in the long run using those renewable resources directly. What about biofuels? Biofuels, I think, have the benefit. They're carbon neutral. However, they also have a very, very low energy return. Biodiesel, I think, is pretty good. Ethanol has a very low energy return, as well as some of the other problems in terms of competing for agricultural land for agriculture. In other words, I have there, it's necessary perhaps to some extent, but it would be very necessary. And the same goes for other renewable resources, wind and solar. Wind and solar, of course, would produce electricity, so we'd have to, you know, change the way we, you know, run vehicles if we use it for vehicles. But more important there, the question is, while they are necessary, they are not going to scale. They are not going to replace oil and gas in the quantities that we have used. Think about it. Oil and natural gas are fossil resources that took millions of years to be condensed into the more, to be refined essentially underground into the most productive resources we've ever found. We didn't use wind and solar in the old days, or we used it as mechanical power, but when we discovered oil and gas, we switched to oil and gas because they were so much more powerful. They are concentrated, they are flexible. Wind and solar are diffuse resources. The effort you have to use to collect it and condense it uses more energy. You get less energy return out of it. So they, while they're necessary, they are not going to be a full substitute. So what's left? We have to use less energy. We have to find ways to use less energy. And that's where I'm going to wind up going, you know, turning over to Daniel, and then I'll come back and cover some of the things that we did in Portland. But fundamentally, we have to learn to use less energy. In conclusion, there was a report done by Robert Hirsch, SAIF, Strategic Applications International, I don't know what it stands for. It's a Beltway company in Washington, D.C. They are consultants to the energy and defense industries. And they did a report for the U.S. Department of Energy about two and a half years ago. And their conclusions were, and this is from a very reputable company, this is the highest government level study that's been done. Number one, the peak is inevitable. Oil and natural gas will peak. It is a physical phenomenon. It will happen. Secondly, the timing is uncertain, but it's possible. In fact, I think they've leaned since that report to say it's probably likely within the next 5 to 10 years. Third, the consequences will be serious. Fourthly, a massive mitigation effort will be needed. We probably need 20 years lead time. It's not something you're going to do overnight. And it will cost, their estimate was in the range of $1 trillion. Who knows? We haven't started down that avenue yet, but it will be an expensive proposition taking many years. And the cost of preparing, lastly, the cost of preparing too late will far exceed the cost of preparing too soon. We need to get busy. And I will return later to talk about what Portland did in terms of looking at some possible impacts and solutions, but for now I will turn it to Daniel, or actually if there are questions first, I guess.
Are there questions from members at this point? There will be an opportunity when we conclude. Representative Peterson, did you ask? Oh, Mr. Lurch, please go ahead and introduce yourself to the tape.
You want to just get...
There we go. Okay. Thank you, Chairman Hilty, Chairwoman Hillstrom, committee members. Thanks for having me here. My name is Daniel Lurch. I'm, as Chairman Hilty mentioned previously, I'm a program manager with Post Carbon Institute, based in Portland, Oregon, and Sebastopol, California. I'm also the author of Post Carbon Cities: Planning for Energy and Climate Uncertainty, the book that Chairman Hilty showed earlier. To our knowledge, this is the first, thank you, for sale online. To our knowledge, this is the first major guidebook written specifically for local government officials and staff on the peak oil issue. And what I'm going to focus on, I do a lot of what Mr. Calvin has discussed already. I'm going to skim over a lot of that. I think it is helpful to see some of that from a slightly different perspective. But I'm going to largely focus on the... this issue of energy and climate uncertainty, which is how we frame the issue in the guidebook. Again, the guidebook itself was released fairly recently. I just completed a tour of the U.S. Northeast. It was fairly well received. City of Providence alone bought 50 copies. So hopefully you'll hear more and more about this, and hopefully people in Minnesota will find it useful as well. I'm going to focus largely on the energy issue. The two big problems that we face right now, of course, are peak oil and climate change. I don't have time to get into climate, but I will mention it briefly. So to go through this fairly quickly, I guess the way that I like to think about the peak oil problem is, just in the most, using the Occam's razor idea, the most simple way possible. The basic issue is that the fundamental factors of oil supply and demand are changing, and pretty much everybody agrees with that, and I think that's important to recognize. There is quite a bit of debate about various issues surrounding oil and peak oil and energy, of course, but it is important to recognize that everyone agrees that fundamentally things are changing. And what is changing? Well, demand is rising, of course, and that supply is leveling and will soon fall. Now, I think one of the biggest things to take away from this whole situation, hopefully from my presentation as well, is this concept that because we're facing fundamental changes, the old assumptions of how we perceive and understand the energy supply system globally, those old assumptions no longer fit. And I think there is no better example of that than this chart from the U.S. Energy Information Administration, the official U.S. energy statistics body. Just from last year, they were showing a potential high price of around $60 for this year, possibly as low as $30. And of course, we are far, far exceeding their wildest projections. And what I personally take from this chart is the lesson that if the people who make it their business, their careers, to understand the energy system, to understand the price of oil, are this far off, then clearly we are facing some serious problems. And the lesson from that, of course, is that we can no longer rely on the usual experts. Just from August of last year, major mainstream media outlets saying why we won't hit 100, the consensus of analysts. At the same time, fortunately, we are seeing more and more people, including leaders of major oil companies, including major political leaders, starting to change the tune. Chevron has been spending millions of dollars of advertising the last couple of years, convincing their shareholders that they understand that things are changing. And even here in the Houston Chronicle, we see that there are now more and more people saying that we are looking at a plateau and decline as early as 2012. Even within the last couple of days, we're starting to see a shift. Just 2 days ago, the chairman of General Motors, Rick Wagoner, said there is no doubt demand for oil is outpacing supply at a rapid pace. This is something you would not have seen him say not that long ago. And even just yesterday, President Bush himself saying basically the same thing. So we are seeing the shift in how this problem is being talked about. A lot of what... excuse me for the coughing. I'm still getting over a cold. A lot of what John talked about is kind of complex. This is a very complex issue, of course. I like to boil it down into the three basic points that I think people need to remember about the oil problem. I'm going to go through these quickly. The easy oil has peaked. As John mentioned, we peaked in discoveries in 1964, 1965. Production of conventional oil does seem to have peaked in 2005. We have not produced more than about 85 million barrels per day of conventional oil since then. The second point is that the difficult oil, and that's the unconventional oil, which John mentioned, can't make up the difference. And a lot of what you hear discussed about in the peak oil debate is that this unconventional oil might make up the difference. And that's what the economists say, that as the price of oil goes up, we will see more investment into this unconventional oil, and this is things like heavy oil in Venezuela, deep water in the Gulf of Mexico, polar up in the Arctic regions, natural gas liquids. But of course, these are the very sources that, as John mentioned, are extremely expensive to produce, are extremely difficult to find in many cases also very environmentally devastating to produce. So if we're simply not going to replace that conventional oil, the lower part of the curve, with unconventional oil at the rate of demand growth. And this is really the problem, I feel, from a government perspective, from a policy perspective. For basically the entire post-war period, we've been on this level of demand growth as the economy has grown. If we're expecting unconventional oil, all these different energy sources, to fill that gap of declining conventional oil, that is an incredibly large gap. And I don't know of any serious economist or government official or banker who honestly thinks that we are going to fill that gap with oil, shale, and nuclear, and deep water. It's simply not going to happen. The third thing to remember about peak oil, of course, is this issue that the remaining oil is not necessarily all of ours to buy. Of course, increasing demand from developing countries, and also the oil that is out there is coming from more troubled parts of the world. This graph is showing how we're seeing an increase of oil coming from places like Venezuela, from Russia, from Nigeria, and less coming from places like the North Sea, which is sources that we used to be able to rely on. The one anomaly here, of course, being the Alberta tar sands, but in some ways that's the exception that proves the rule. And, of course, much more going to places like China and Southeast Asia. So what does this mean from a policy perspective for government officials and government staff? For facing declining supply and rising demand, economists will tell you what that means. We're going to face higher oil prices, but also oil price and supply volatility. And in some ways, it's the volatility that is the real issue. The Hirsch Report, which John also mentioned, makes the point of this, that as we approach peak oil, as we experience that, these problems, relatively minor events, so things like an uprising in Nigeria, things like a hurricane going through the Gulf Coast, things like countries like Iran and Venezuela using fossil fuels as political bargaining chips, things that did not have an enormous impact necessarily on the global oil market previously because we had enough surplus production, these things will start to have more pronounced impacts. And of course, this is what we have in fact been seeing. When Nigeria experienced an uprising, I think it was about 2 years ago now, and about 1 million barrels of oil per day went offline from the global economy, the price of oil reacted in a way that we hadn't seen before, and that's just the beginning. My book and my work at Post Carbon is focused specifically on cities. I do a lot of support for local government. We're trying to help local leaders, local staff understand why this is a problem specifically for cities. Because at the end of the day, if people can't get around their cities, if we can't move goods within cities, that is the real problem for our national economy. So I'm going to talk now for briefly about why this is a specific problem for what local governments, and to a certain degree, by extension, state government, needs to be thinking about this. The first piece is our overdependence of oil, and this doesn't come as a surprise to anyone, I think. Oil is absolutely essential as a raw material. John covered that quite well. I think this quote by Daniel Yergin is actually one of the few economists out there who is very much anti the peak oil concept, ironically, but he understands our dependence on oil. Makes it possible to transport food to the megacities, provides the bricks and mortar of contemporary civilization. That's, I think, a very appropriate image. also important is this concept, I think, of oil as an assumed input. All the decisions that we make in government, all the decisions that we make in business, investment decisions, et cetera, think of the big highway projects, the transit projects that we invest in, all assume that oil is going to be available tomorrow and next month and next year, and also that oil is going to be relatively affordable. But those are the very factors that are starting to change. So when those assumptions start to change, what does that then mean for our ability to make reasonable and conservative and smart investments using public dollars? This is a very big concern. And the third piece, of course, is this issue of oil being a non-interchangeable input. Again, John covered this very well. You're not going to replace oil and oil products in their transportability, in their energy content, with things like nuclear, wind, ethanol, that sort of thing. It is simply unlike any other substance on Earth. And another way I like to think of it is that this ready and cheap supply of both oil and natural gas is presupposed and essential to our economy as the supply of potable water. Now, there are a series of short-term challenges that are very interesting when we think about what oil price and supply volatility means. Of course, we start to see unexpected price changes in oil products. And a great example of this is in the summer of 2006, the price of oil on average went up about 5% versus the summer of 2005. The price of asphalt, however, went up double. And in some parts of the country, it even went up triple. Now, the reason for that is that asphalt, of course, is a byproduct of refining a barrel of oil. It's the last thing you get at its lowest value. So when the price of oil went up, refiners had an incentive to produce more of the high-value stuff and, of course, less of the asphalt. So for local governments, needing to pave streets, needing to repair streets, very essential to the local economy, suddenly they were faced with this price spike that in many cases they were not prepared for. The way this panned out across the country is very interesting, and this really drives home the need for local, and I would say to a certain degree, state government leaders to be thinking about this, and not just assuming that the market is going to take care of the problem or the federal government is going to be taking care of the problem. Cities that had plans for volatility in oil and asphalt prices were fine. They could continue paving their streets. They could continue repairing them. Other cities, even cities just next door to them, had to cancel street projects, as you can see from this clipping from a newspaper. And later on in the story, it talks about many cities, in this case in Tennessee, many cities simply had to cancel or scale back very much their street paving and repair projects. That has impacts, of course, on local employment, on local construction. Again, speaking to the complexity and the system complexity and the way that oil and oil products affect the local and state economy. We also start to see price changes in other products. Of course, ethanol, we've seen in the last couple of years a hike in meat prices as subsidies have gone to producing more ethanol, and farmers have found it more profitable to produce ethanol than sending their corn to the feedstock. And I think that very much speaks to the way in which government is responding to high oil prices. That's another factor in this complexity. And then finally, the short-term challenges for cities is how are cities going to deal with potential shortages? An interesting example that we can look at from recent experiences in Hurricane Katrina. In September of 2005, when Katrina went through the Gulf of Mexico, one of the things that happened was that it shut down an oil products pipeline that was providing much of the U.S. Southeast with petroleum. A colleague of mine up in Seattle did a study of what this meant for municipalities in North Carolina, where they suddenly woke up the day after Katrina and found that all of their gas stations were without a regular supply of petroleum. Local leaders, of course, wanted to keep their police cars and emergency vehicles on the road, went to the state. They knew the state had a strategic petroleum reserve, and they said, all right, please release the gasoline. We need to keep things on the road. The state turned around and said, well, actually, this petroleum reserve is for our use. We need it for our state troopers, and you local leaders are on your own. Now, of course, there is a huge lesson there for local leaders, and since I'm speaking to a state audience, also state leaders. I think we can see that local governments tend to assume, and I think in general we always assume to a certain degree, that there is some higher level of government that is looking out for our most basic needs and is thinking about our vulnerabilities. And as we can see, in many ways, Katrina has shown that local leaders, even state leaders, need to be looking out for their own vulnerabilities. And I would say state leaders need to be thinking about local government's vulnerabilities, because there is not necessarily anybody making these connections and thinking about them. Finally, there's a set of long-term challenges. What will this whole issue of oil supply and price volatility mean for the global economy? What will it mean for our ability to move all the goods that supply our Walmarts and Home Depots from halfway across the world in China? How will this impact regional and local economies? The main point here is how can, again, I speak generally to cities, but I would say this is very much applicable to state leaders as well. How can we set meaningful budgets? How can we make these long-range land use and transportation plans? How can we serve our constituents with so much uncertainty surrounding this most essential material? And this is what we mean in the guidebook about this frame of energy uncertainty. We don't talk about peak oil. Peak oil is not the problem. Peak oil is, as John mentioned, a phenomenon. It's a phenomenon of petroleum geology. The problem is the uncertainty that peak oil generates because of that gap between business as usual demand and declining supply. Our stance on peak oil at Post Carbon Institute is what's underlined up here. This is drawn from our own research and looking at the research of others. We seem to be facing an undulating plateau of world oil production from 2007 onward, and this is in fact what we're seeing, but permanent decline likely underway by 2010, so indeed quite soon. Very briefly about global warming, because the two issues, of course, are related in the way that we need to respond to them. I think you can look at global warming the same way we look at peak oil. There are some fundamental factors of change that everyone pretty much agrees with. Greenhouse gas concentrations up dramatically and rising. At the same time, the effects we all know about at the global level. There are similar issues of dependence and short-term challenges and long-term challenges. Simply to summarize, that we can look at these challenges and also frame the climate change problem as an issue of uncertainty. There's uncertainty in how the global ecosystem and the climate is changing. There's uncertainty as to how our responses to climate change are going to affect climate change. There's uncertainty about how these things will affect the economy at different scales, local and global. Again, all problems for policymakers. One of the things we do in the guidebook and in my work at Post Carbon is trying to think of these two problems of peak oil and global warming in the same frame. And I think this is a really key point. We're starting to see more and more people in the energy and climate advocacy communities excuse me, talk about it in this way, that the sense that there is, we need to, the convergence of the peak oil and climate issues. But if we are only looking at climate change, we may make decisions that are bad and that we would not make if we were looking at the peak oil issue. And vice versa, to give one example, for many years we have been talking about responding to global warming by investing in natural gas, because natural gas is, when you burn it, you produce fewer greenhouse gases, is always talked about as a cleaner fuel. But of course the peak oil concept tells you that, well, we actually face a supply constraint in natural gas and other fuels. So that's not an option. So I don't have time to go into this into depth, but I think that, again, as policymakers, as officials, it is important to think of these two issues in the same frame. I'm going to transition now and wrap up by talking about what some cities have been doing so far about peak oil, and then conclude with our recommendations at Post Carbon. Starting, though, with climate change first, we are seeing, of course, quite a bit of action on climate change, especially the last year. There was this really big turnaround on climate change in 2007. We've been seeing many cities develop local action plans of global warming over the last 15 years. More recently, we've been seeing cities focus on adaptation as well. This report on the right is a relatively new initiative from a number of different cities and counties. We've also seen this big upwelling of grassroots and local action on climate change. The U.S. Mayor's Climate Protection Agreement, recently adopted by the U.S. Conference of Mayors, now has over 600 mayors that have signed on to climate change. We're starting to see this to a certain degree now with peak oil. As of mid-2007, and this has changed a little bit since then, we've seen about 15 to 20 different local governments throughout the United States have some sort of official response to peak oil, ranging from the tiny town of Franklin of 2,500 in New York all the way up to the Los Angeles region, nearly 18 million. These governments are doing a variety of things. We're seeing internal reports. Burnaby and the regional government of Portland both did assessments for internal consumption about what peak oil might mean for their own responsibilities. We're seeing public reports, committees of citizens appointed by cities and city officials looking into the problem, and Portland is one of those. I'll speak to that a bit later. Cities passing resolutions simply acknowledging the problem, and in many cases encouraging their congressional delegations and their state legislatures to look into the issue, trying to develop a broader sense of urgency here. And then finally, we're seeing cities develop task forces. Portland was the first. John will get into this in greater detail later. We've also seen Oakland, California, San Francisco, California, Austin, Texas, and most recently Bloomington, Indiana, develop task forces as well. Very briefly about the Portland task force, it came about actually because of a grassroots initiative, a citizens group called Portland Peak Oil. John was, you can see his name up there, he was integral in developing this briefing book that described a lot of what he presented before. The task force meant for, I believe it was 8 or 9 months, split up into different committees and looked at these different sectors of transportation and land use, social services, food and agriculture, and basically tried to identify what are the ways in which this issue of peak oil is going to affect the most basic functioning of our local economy, and also of the local governments and local businesses. It was a very broad effort. We encouraged cities to look at the Portland model, look at the process that they used and the recommendations that they came up with. And I'll go through the recommendations very briefly, just so you can get a sense of what it is that cities are starting to think about how they can respond to this. The very top recommendation out of 11, we were very glad to see this at Post Carbon, the priority on reducing consumption, by far the best thing and the easiest thing and the quickest thing we can do to reduce our exposure to high prices and the vulnerability within our economies is to reduce that consumption of energy. If we're not buying as much, if we're not purchasing as much energy, then the volatility and that price will not affect our economy and our institutions nearly as much. Portland is, it was kind of interesting to see them set such a stark goal for reducing oil and natural gas consumption, 50% over the next 25 years. But that is, I mean, that's 2% per year. But that is the degree of commitment that cities need to start making if we're going to address this problem. The education piece is also very important. A lot of people don't know about the problem. As I mentioned earlier, the public discussion about peak oil is still very much surrounding debating whether it even exists, whether it's a problem. If you have big oil companies and the U.S. federal government saying that it's not a problem, then mobilization will not happen as easily. And that is, in many ways, an extremely important thing that government at the state and local levels can do is to push the issue and educate stakeholders and citizens. Also engaging stakeholders and citizens. I'll speak about this in a little bit later. Transportation and land use is absolutely an important thing as well. Our biggest sector of consuming energy is in the transportation sector. And as I mentioned, I'll discuss this briefly in a minute, we can't separate transportation from land use. Unfortunately, in the United States system, we have this situation where land use tends to happen, regulation of land use occurs at the local level, but transportation, of course, is funded at the state and federal level, and becomes a, I don't need to tell this audience, that it is an incredible challenge to push things like smart growth and new urbanism and smart transit-oriented development. Designing infrastructure to promote different options so that we do have ways of moving people and goods that don't rely on fossil fuels, encouraging energy efficiency through both the carrot and the stick, preserving farmland so that we don't have to transport food from 3,000 miles away and meeting those most basic needs locally, supporting the green economy, sustainable economy, and of course the social safety net, even contingency plans to a certain degree. And again, John will get into this later. I'll conclude by talking about what we call the five long-term principles. These are more general things that we encourage governments to keep in mind in addressing peak oil. It's very easy to get lost in the details and focus on things like green roofs, on renewable support, you know, building wind turbines and solar panels and all the small individual fixes. But I think because this is such a complex system problem, looking at it from 30,000 feet, as it were, is incredibly important for the long term. And kind of repeating that Portland point, transportation and land use is in many ways really the top thing that we do need to be thinking about. In fact, this is wording directly out of the book, deal with transportation and land use, or you may as well stop now. And we were being somewhat humorous, but also trying to be directly to the point there. This built-in oil dependency of our cities and suburbs is the biggest obstacle to significantly reducing our energy use. It's not just the way in which we consume the most oil, it's that we've invested trillions of dollars in infrastructure, in highways, in buildings, in the whole gasoline distribution and retail system. This is not going to change overnight. And when the Hirsch Report, as John and I both mentioned, says that we have a minimum of 10 years of massive government effort to address this problem, it's talking about that oil-based, oil-focused, oil-dependent infrastructure. We absolutely need to be focused on this now. The way in which we can focus on this at the local level, and again, this really kind of highlights the problem, it's not just about the green roofs. A lot of cities now are converting their traffic lights from incandescent lights to LED lights because that's a big energy savings. Those are easy things to do. Those are the low-hanging fruit. What we really need to be doing, though, is really fundamentally rethinking the way in which we actually do land use and transportation plans. And planners and officials don't like to hear that. Planners especially, and I say that as a planner. It's a complex system that we work within, and this is not something that's going to change overnight either, the way in which we do land use transportation planning. But it needs to happen, and fortunately there are models out there. There are this example here from the Rocky Mountain Land Use Institute, ways of thinking of zoning codes to actually make things like zero-energy building par for the course and not something that you need to get a special permit for, making it just a matter of course that we're going to be, that we build buildings, that we build neighborhoods and cities in a smart way. That's simply not the case now, but we can change these things. Making land use and transportation infrastructure decisions with 100-year time frame. Again, we don't think of this in long terms, and we should. I mentioned in the guidebook that a recent study looked at the guidebooks that transportation engineers use to do their work, and the study found that by and large, transportation engineers are taught to look at simply what's happened in the preceding decades in terms of energy costs and extend it into the future. And certainly this is what many businesses and many professions do. We simply, you know, extend that linear analysis. Well, that trend, of course, is changing. The problem is our professionals don't know about that. It has not been, that realization has not been integrated into our planning and investment and decision-making processes. And clearly the message here is that if we don't make that integration, we're going to start making, and I would argue we are already making, very bad decisions that are not going to work out very well in the coming years. Thinking in 100-year time frames, or even, you know, a 40-year time frame, a lot of what Portland has achieved in its transportation and land use planning is because we have a 40-year regional transportation plan that has some teeth behind it. Most cities, you know, will do the 5-year comp plan, and that's pretty much it. So that's a very direct leadership piece that government officials can take on right away. Organizing with neighboring jurisdictions, regional governments, that's, of course, a problem in this country. We don't have effective regional governments here in the Twin Cities. Of course, you have one of the stronger regional coordination bodies, but like the Portland region, it still it does not do what it needs to do. Unfortunately, of course, we can't deal with transportation and land use if we are not also dealing with neighboring jurisdictions. That's hopefully something that we can see more of here. The second piece is tackling private energy consumption. If we are only focused on government expenditures of energy, which is what we've tended to see, again, because that's the easiest thing to take care of, then we're not going to reduce community-wide vulnerability. So engaging the business community, using the tools that we already have, using examples from Western Europe, far ahead of us, and it's, the technology is there, we can certainly adopt it. Looking at the way in which we do building construction is I think, a very quick way we can adopt that. Third, attacking the problems piece by piece and from many angles. This really speaks to something we've seen in the climate change community. This graph here, this is from Princeton University, where they were looking at ways of reducing the projected path of greenhouse gas emissions instead of by a single silver bullet solution, or waiting for us to develop fusion energy or investing whole hog in nuclear, for example. They suggested that one said we can reduce that projected level of greenhouse gas emissions by using multiple tactics using existing technology. And you can see up here, we can use efficiency, increasing transport efficiency, reducing vehicle miles traveled, investing in renewables, perhaps using some additional fossil fuel new technology like SIM fuel. Someone mentioned down at the Association for the Study of Peak Oil Conference in Houston a few months ago, there are no silver bullets, but there are many silver BBs through dealing with this issue. And I think this really does speak to the silver BBs. We can also apply this to the energy situation. There's that business as usual demand and declining supply gap that I mentioned before. Well, there's a certain amount of demand reduction and demand destruction that can happen. And there's also a certain amount of new energy that we can develop, whether it's renewable or making better use of existing fossil fuel resources, to fill that gap. And again, that's the key point. Filling that gap so that we don't have these massive fluctuations in energy price, which is what really hampers the economy. Making fundamental changes, this really speaks to leadership and stakeholders. I've said quite a bit about that already. And then finally, and this, people are often surprised that this is up here, but building a sense of community. This really, what this speaks to is a sense of social resilience, and especially at the local level. I think we probably don't think of this too much at the state level and certainly not the federal level. But at the local level, part of why I think we see so much action on climate change in local governments, we're starting to see it on peak oil, is that at the local level, local leaders are, you know, they have personal relationships with the business community, they have personal relationships with community groups, and they have a sense that if there is a challenge that is going to affect the economy as a whole, it's going to affect the people that they know and the stakeholders that they know and the institutions that they're invested in. And they recognize that it's those relationships and what sociologists call social capital that can provide a bulwark against these problems that come from the outside. And, you know, to give one example, Jane Jacobs, in her seminal book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities, talks about the case of Kitty Genovese back in the, I believe it was the 60s or the 50s. This woman was brutally murdered in a public housing complex, and police afterwards interviewed residents of the complex, and they found that many people had heard her screams, but no one came to help her because someone felt it was their problem. And that's an example of a place with no community resilience, no sense of social capital, no sense of an institution, a community institution that is going to help people deal with problems. The flip side of that, places that do have community resilience, is, for example, every time there's a big natural disaster somewhere in the middle of the country, a tornado goes through somewhere, we're always amazed as a country that people are going out helping each other. This is always in the news headlines. People are giving each other water. Places that do have community resilience can deal with unexpected crises. And I would class peak oil in some ways as an unexpected crisis. And if we have problems with energy supply, problems with energy price, the more that our communities, you know, citizens and businesses and elected officials have those pre-existing relationships, the more that they can develop the local solutions that are needed and not be completely dependent on the state and federal government to swoop in and help, as I mentioned before in the Hurricane Katrina case. Local governments, of course, can do a lot to build a sense of community, from promoting local democracy, with neighborhood associations, developing a mix of uses in neighborhoods, having, you know, people being able to live and work in the same neighborhood. In short, doing anything that we can do to get people talking with each other and investing themselves in the larger community. So to summarize, and this is kind of the conclusion of the guidebook as well, to break dependence on oil, to stop contributing to global warming, and to build resilient cities that can actually thrive in this new age of energy and climate uncertainty, the bottom line really is to reduce consumption and also produce locally. Now, by produce locally, we don't mean to turn our backs on the global economy. We can't do that, and we should not do that. Producing locally really means to find those ways that we can source our most basic needs, whether it's energy, basic manufactured goods, food, from as locally as possible. And there is a lot that local and state governments both can do to support that. The current economy that we have, where, as I mentioned before, we're shipping and spending enormous amounts of energy to bring our basic goods from across the ocean, from China, from California, wherever it's coming, that simply is not a tenable model in a future of high energy, high oil prices that we've been describing to you. The market is not going to solve this solution on its own. I think that's also clear as well. Markets, you know, if looking at what the markets are looking at now, I mean, again, think back to that that news article from CNN. You know, the market's not predicting what's going to happen. And if you think about the Hearst report, we do need this 10 to 15 year period of infrastructure investment and response to deal with it. So there's absolutely a need for governments to step up to the plate, for government leaders to step up to the plate and start thinking about how we can address this issue. I encourage people to go to our website there, and also feel free to contact me by email. And I believe we can take some questions now. We have some time.
Yes, Representative Elton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On your slide that it was the number, that number C, attack the problem piece by piece and from many angles, and then you had a chart and you must have listed maybe 12 or 15 points, and they all look equal. They all look equal. But from what we know, don't we know that some things are bigger problems than others, and attacking them will have far greater impact? I would just list how we build buildings and our dependence on cars, and if we lifted them up, shouldn't there be a set of priorities in case in terms of how we're going to to tackle them. As I thought about that and your whole kind of global view, often, at least in our state, when we look at public mass transit, rural communities tend to think of that as only an urban issue, but one could perhaps argue that rural communities have something to gain from urban transit, because the more we solve the problem there, the more of the resources left over for farming and transit where they don't have choices. That interdependency of communities is something we haven't thought about.
Absolutely. What this chart obviously is meant to be theoretical, and just meant to show the point that there are multiple ways in which we can address this. I would certainly expect that at the state level and at the local level, the responses will be quite varied. I mean, what makes sense in Minnesota will not make sense in Florida, clearly. And in some ways, that does speak to the need for local and state action. The federal government simply cannot see things in terms of the level of resolution. They can't see the details. They can't see what would make sense in one place versus another as easily as state and local leaders can. You're also absolutely right about the relationship between the rural and the urban, and this is also an issue we face this in Oregon and pretty much around the country. There's always the urban-rural divide up in Canada as well. I heard a lot about this in my tour. In many ways, I feel that does underline the need for that cross-jurisdictional coordination and organization. I was just in Montreal a few months ago, and the city leaders there complained bitterly that while they want to do a lot of the things that we talked about, they simply can't because the rural representatives have more power over the regional transportation funding, the way that their regional transportation dollars are shared, and they simply could not find solutions in their particular situation. So ultimately, these are, of course, political decisions that need to be made. And I would certainly suggest that helping rural constituencies and suburban constituencies and urban constituencies understand that this is a common problem, that we are talking about the global and state and regional and local economies, and that we do need to have this broad base of coordination. That hopefully that is a way that we can develop the political support to do the sorts of investments that we need to make.
And then, either of your presentations was what could you do with garbage?
Just work.
Well, that's a good question. Recycling. That is an interesting issue. A number of municipalities have been looking again at municipal incineration as a way of producing energy. There are some examples, particularly from Scandinavia, of what is purported to be clean waste incineration for producing energy, both for producing electricity, but also for before you burn it, you can digest it and get methane out of there. So that's certainly something to look into, but the broader issue of overconsumption and waste generation and hauling the waste, expending energy to do that, that's certainly a big key thing to look at as well.
Mr. Kaufman? Thank you, Representative Hilty. In answer to that question also, I mean, the generation is something you can do. It is third on the list of priorities. Number one is we should be just using less stuff. Go back to the conventional reduce, reuse, recycle. Use less. Buy less, throw less stuff away, reuse it. I mean, our policy we've developed in Oregon for tax credits, is we encourage material recovery first. And we will not give tax credits for energy projects if there is indeed a legitimate material recovery that they could have done instead. And only thirdly is if you can't recover the materials, if it's really that unusable, then go ahead and consider generating energy from it. And even if it generates energy, it's going to be a very small wedge. It is nowhere near, meeting our needs.
I should also just mention that in this chart does mention nuclear energy, but post-carbon is very much against nuclear. We just don't see that as an option. Disclaimer.
Representative Breyer.
I have two questions, Mr. Chair, and either of you can jump in, and maybe the answer to my first is to read your guidebook. But I come from a community that's a mid-sized regional center, and we've had a long-range planning process, and in the course of that process, there was a strong commitment to supporting density, urban villages, if you will, some take on that. The difficulty we've run into is practical strategies for actually doing that. You mentioned zoning, but I wonder if you have other strategies that can be taken up in the shortest range to actually move forward developers and construction people and the planning process to get that commitment to the viability of supporting density in building.
Mr. Coffey?
Yeah. Representative Hilty and Representative Reinert.
Right.
We have, I guess I'd say that part of the solution to that is, you know, Portland metro area has done something. They have what's called an urban growth boundary. And the urban growth boundary basically freezes the limit beyond which, you know, urban development can go. And it's metropolitan-wide. It's not just the city of Portland. It's metropolitan-wide. You know, the three counties in the Portland metropolitan area and all the jurisdictions. And there is an urban growth boundary. And there, at one point, there were rigid lines. And that forced development, instead of going out, it forced the development to stay within those bounds and come in a little bit. And so that was one piece of it. In addition to just the zoning, you know, that was one piece. Another piece that made a big difference was the light rail system that Portland put in, because that attracted businesses and residential development near the light rail line. You know, I mean, it's a great, great opportunity for density and for businesses. I mean, they see that, the developers see that. They want to locate their apartment buildings or their complexes and their businesses near that light rail line to service it and to get people, you know, who are coming on and off those trains. And that really developed a lot of clusters, which refer back to what you're saying is the urban village concept. You know, because then you've got little pockets here and here and here, you know, where you really encourage that mixed use. So those would be the two that I would say. And I don't know how appropriate they are in a mid-sized city like you've got, but in the Portland metropolitan area, they were very effective.
Mr. Larson, do you want to add something?
Thank you, Representative. Yeah, I would also, speaking as a transportation planner, at least that's my background, I think that the key lesson there, and this really is also the lesson from the Portland experience, is that, you know, there is no one easy fix. As I mentioned previously, Portland has been doing this for 30 years. And you look at other cities, like Copenhagen, Denmark is another example that's often used. You know, and they've been doing what they've been doing for 40 years. It's very tempting, and I've seen this in just my own professional career, that a concept like new urbanism or smart growth comes around, and people want to jump on the bandwagon. And they think by just passing a couple of zoning codes or changing the comp plan a little bit that they're going to get the desired result. And of course, you know, the market is responding to a wide variety of things. So I think, you know, using a variety, looking at land use and transportation, incentives and regulations, short-term investments, long-term investments, it really always goes back to that regional coordination and the long-term view. And I think, and unfortunately, those are two things that are very, very difficult to do in our system.
And Representative Brian,
my second question is a broader philosophical question, and you may choose to respond or not as you choose, but two pieces about our economy is predicated on, obviously, a growth and consumption model. And when we look at the current discussions around recession, the solution people talk about most often is put money in consumers' pockets. How, in light of peak oil, do we move forward a shift in that approach to our economy, which it depends on consumption? Well, you're asking big questions, so I'm asking them back.
Mr. Coffman,
Representative Primary, I've never been asked that question before, so I don't know. I think the best I could come up with is just simply say, you know, we need to just plain start now. We can't wait. We can't dither anymore. I mean, you know, the time for dithering is over. We need to get busy and do some of this stuff. And it's going to require changes. We're going to have to find new ways of doing things, and that's probably one of them. I don't
I don't know. I guess that's not a very good answer, but.
Mr. Lewis?
Thank you. I'm trying to reduce my amount of talking, but this is these are important issues. At Post-Carver, we talk a lot about the concept of relocalization, which is, again, focused on, as I mentioned before, trying to help communities meet their most basic needs as locally as possible. And a big part of that is about, you know, local dollars, where local dollars are being spent, keeping them within the community, making sure that they're going to things like renewable energy and local business. There are some models of how that can be done. There are some cities that have, there's this whole economic localization movement that's been around for, I'd say, about 10 or 15 years now. Michael Schumann, who wrote Going Local, is a good resource on that. But yeah, I think overall, just looking at local solutions, local resources, local dollars, I think are three things to keep in mind as ways of finding solutions for this very complex problem.
Representative Bogini.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you both coming to Minnesota and having this conversation with us. It's very helpful. We have a pretty good building code, and I am very confident that it's going to get a lot better very quickly. But my concern is a lot of us represent, you know, it's across the board, urban, suburban, rural, old housing stock that was built before the building code. Have you, and they look like this. I live in one of them. I mean, 1929 house. But it's common. Did you all adopt any strategies to deal with that piece of the puzzle? And I have a second question.
Mr. Lewis?
I don't have a very specific answer for you, unfortunately, other than to say that yes, retrofitting existing buildings is something that I do hear talked a lot about. And more often. One interesting change I've seen in the last 2 years is the architecture profession has really started to embrace green buildings and the sustainable practices overall. There's I don't know if you call them a movement or an organization called Architecture 2030 that has been really pushing re-educating professional architects. And of course we've seen, you know, the lead leadership for energy and, oh, I forget what it stands for.
Environmental
development design. LEED green building standards are being widely adopted, and those are starting to change. You know, instead of just LEED silver, gold, and platinum, now we have LEED neighborhood development. Hopefully we'll see LEED retrofitting at some point as well. So I think the trend is in the right direction, but I think there is I mean, in some ways, retrofitting, weatherization, and there is so much history of that, of course, from the oil crises of the 1970s, that there's obviously a lot that state programs in particular can do for that.
Well, perhaps this is part of the answer to the question, to Representative Barnhart's question, how to keep money local, jobs, and do something for folks locally. But so leads us thinking of doing a retrofit. That sounds good to me, because I think we'll do the rest. But
I don't know that they are thinking of doing a retrofit.
They do. They have a standard, at least in draft form. It might have even passed already. I think it was just adopted in the last couple of months.
That's super. My second question was following up on the garbage question of Representative Housen. We have a huge amount of compost that is not being recycled, and it's just being hauled around. Has anybody looked at the figures of reducing the carbon footprint by essentially where you can doing out local at home composting rather than hauling the garbage around? Are there numbers there to help us out?
Well, that's an interesting question. Normally, the question is about how can we get centralized composting, and you're kind of going in a different direction there. I could find figures for you if you would like. But that is in some ways the next big thing in waste management, is separating not only recyclables from the waste pool, but also compostables. And I think that that would have an enormous amount of import. I think we're starting to look at that in Portland, and many European cities do that already. Anything to reduce the amount of energy needed to haul.
It's the hauling issue that I'm particularly interested in, because here, too, people say, oh, we will haul it to 16 central spots in Minnesota. And I'm thinking of those hauling distances and thinking, that's the most carbon inefficient thing I can think of.
Absolutely.
Mr. Kaufman.
Representative Hilty, Representative Wagner.
I want to go back to the first question real quick on the existing buildings. I had just one additional comment there. Again, don't know the answers necessarily. One thing we have tried, we have failed. Twice, City of Portland failed once, and we failed at the State of Oregon, you know, just due to political resistance. This is a very tough nut to crack, these existing homes. But what we tried to get in place was some kind of a standard, insulation standard, or even a labeling standard for homes when they're up for sale, when you're reselling it. And to either have the homes weatherized at that point or have a labeling system, a rating system or something. And again, I mean, I understand, people resist that, and I understand it. You know, it's perfectly understandable. I may not agree with it. I may think that, yes, for energy reasons, we have to bite that bullet and go ahead. But nonetheless, I understand the resistance to it, and, that has been... Yeah, I see that as a potential solution, but it does have that political nut to crack. Representative Lagini.
Yeah, just one more follow-up. That would be a hard nut to crack here, too, but when I look at the cost of energy for folks, I'm thinking that they will want to do more retrofitting, and so on. What I'm trying to hone in on is how do we help out, and that's what I'm trying to hone in on. So if you all think of something, you let us know.
Again, I would point you to, and there are many examples of state weatherization grants, whether it's to local governments or to local nonprofits that do that. When you look at the natural gas issue, does not get talked about nearly as much as it should, but so many homes are heated by natural gas, and when those prices have already gone through the roof, they're far higher now than what they were projected to be at this time, 7 years ago. I've been following it. And I think that in some ways, I mean, that the whole social safety net issue, which John mentioned earlier, and we'll talk about it a bit more when he talks about the passports, dealing with heating costs, and especially in the climate like Minnesota, of course, is going to be an enormous issue. So getting those weatherization programs in now is going to be incredibly important.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank the chairs for having this hearing and also letting a member of the Transportation Committee crash the party here. But I do appreciate your comment to that point about transportation and land use being really key to addressing this issue. And my question is, for either of you, are there any studies, maybe Portland or somewhere else, that has actually correlated transit use with specific amount of gallons of gas saved or conserved through that, or even ballpark figures? I would imagine it's pretty high.
Representative Hilty, Representative Hornstein. Yes, I came across something recently. City of Portland Global Warming Commission, a Global Warming Report. I recall seeing some kind of a statement that the light rail development, the smart growth policies that they have instituted, have result in a 33% saving, of transportation, 33% reduction in transportation use for the residents and the businesses that live along that corridor.
Thank you. And then just quickly, I would say, with that statistic, I'll take a crack maybe at Representative Reiner's excellent question, which is, maybe with $4, $5, $6 a gallon gas perhaps around the corner, and maybe you could comment on how close we are to that. It seems like clearly transit in the metropolitan region, at least, and even in the rural areas, is a way to put money in consumers' pockets, as well as, of course, energy conservation and efficiency. But do you even have a sense? I know you had that CNN money slide, saying, well, speculation isn't really helpful, but do you have a sense of you know, how close we are to that 4, 5, or 6 gallon oil or gas at the pump.
Mr. Kaufman?
I don't want to go there.
No, don't want to go there. I don't make those kind of predictions.
Yeah.
Mr. Lurch.
It is hard to predict. So I've seen some analyses that look at why we don't have more excess gas than we do now, considering the price of oil compared to what it is during the crises of the 1970s. And household, the percentage of household expenditures going to transportation fuel has declined quite a bit since the 70s. So we do have quite a bit more elasticity in transportation energy demand. So it is hard to tell. At the same time, you know, again, and this is really kind of the problem, one of the problems that peak oil creates, and why the volatility is a problem, and not just high prices. If it was just high prices, if we knew that price was going to go up regularly, we could plan for it and prepare for it. But because there's volatility of supply and price, then, you know, we could, like North Carolina experiences, when their supply was suddenly shut down, suddenly the price of gasoline goes through the roof because it's simply not available. And that's going to be among the problems that we're going to be facing. How do people get to work on, you know, by week 3, by week 4 of $5 gasoline if we're not prepared for it? And that's why, you know, that's what I mean about reducing our vulnerability. The more that people, and there's an interesting anecdote from Portland. You know, a lot of people look at Portland as a place that, you know, might fare reasonably well relative to other cities and other metro areas in a higher energy price scenario. One of the reasons being that if you live in inner Portland like I do, I can bike, I can walk, I can take the light rail, I can take the bus, I can take a car share vehicle. I've got 5 different options. Where I grew up in suburban New Jersey, I had 1 option. So I'm in a much better situation for meeting my basic needs, for, you know, playing my role in the local economy in Portland because of 30 years of work on all these issues than it was in suburban New Jersey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, I should mention we have 5 names on the list, and we do have another leg of the presentation that Mr. Kaufman is going to do, in which possibly might answer some of these questions, but if that turns out to be the case, I appreciate you mentioning that. And I would mention also that we have arranged, since I managed to get both of these guys here at the same time, to do presentations in other parts of the state. And as soon as we finish this hearing, we have to hit the road for Duluth. And tomorrow we'll be doing a presentation in Rochester tomorrow afternoon, and in South Minneapolis and Representative Quarantine's district at 7 o'clock. So if you could try to keep the questions as brief as possible, we'd appreciate it, because I don't want to get picked up for speeding on the way to Duluth. Representative Kalin.
Great choice, Mr. Chair. Thank you, gentlemen. I just want to emphasize for everybody in the room that the more that we focus on tighter building standards, the better Minnesota benefits, because we're the Silicon Valley of windows. With Anderson, Marvin, Cardinal Glass, we now actually have a dynamic glazing company that just is on tap for $30 million expansion near Rochester, where you guys will be. It's actually terrible. But, so thank you. Keep growing Minnesota's economy as much as we can that way.
You especially want to thank us in Portland for the building code standards that we have.
Hope that we can tighten it, beat you guys to the punch here this coming session. But a question about the urban growth boundary and related to things that we might consider here in the legislature next or this coming session. I believe, from my vague dark catacombs in my memory from architecture school, that it was an action by the legislature and the governor in 77 that mandated local cities to establish their urban growth boundary. Am I right on that?
That it was an act of the legislature in 1973.
1973.
That's correct.
And Mr. Chair, just and so Portland is the one that we always point to as having the greatest impact, but did every city actually comply with that requirement, and did we have similar effects?
Every
farm fields and
Representative Hilty, Representative Kalin, yes, every city had to comply with the law. The law in 1973, actually, you may be right on the urban growth boundary. The law in 1973 was requiring all jurisdictions to develop land use plans, and they set out a system at the time, I think it was 13 statewide goals, it is currently 18 goals. You know, reduce scale conservation, reduce, you know, land use, reduce transportation needs, I mean, whatever the goals all were. And all the cities had to comply. So all the cities came through with land use plans that addressed those needs, and they had a process, you know, with the land use board of appeals, so to speak, that they would look at the plans and they said, would say, this is not meet the goals. You need to go back and redo it. And a few local governments had to do that. So. But the urban growth boundary, you may be right. The urban growth boundary wasn't required by law. No other jurisdiction has the urban growth boundary like the Portland Metropolitan District area.
Okay.
They were the only one that did that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the great presentation. I've always felt that we should use the first R, reduce the consumption and conserve the precious resources that we have. But, for instance, in home, and I like to start small, so in home, in residences, the natural gas usage. I was just visiting yesterday with a gentleman from Wisconsin who designed solar hot water heaters. And we've tried to further the use of geothermal and solar so that we're using fewer of the resources that we want to last longer. But he was telling me that Wisconsin has an incentive program, I think it's a rebate, for home solar water heaters, and Minnesota does not. And I'm wondering if Portland does, and if so, how is it funded? And in the times of short natural funding in this recessionary time for states, how have you affected some of those changes?
Representative Hilty, Representative
Galfi.
State of Oregon provides a residential tax credit of up to 25% of the cost, up to $1,500 for solar systems, for solar water heaters. That used to also be the case for photovoltaics for the solar electric systems, but in the last legislative session they increased that to $6,000. With a maximum of $1,500 in any given year, but you could get a tax credit for up to $6,000 for the photovoltaic system. So you could install a larger photovoltaic system, rather than doing it in increments over 4 years and claiming a different tax credit each year. Like you put it in 1 year, get the tax credit, but you claim it over 4 years. But for the solar water heater, it's $1,500. Back in the early 1980s, I actually was hired as the solar specialist in 1980 and ran the tax credit program during the early years. At the time, we had a federal tax credit as well, and it took off. It skyrocketed. When the federal tax credit went away and the energy prices dropped in the mid-80s, the market for solar collapsed, and we, even with the tax credit, we were giving 200 tax credits a year through most of the 1990s and the early 2000s. That has now started to climb again. We are probably up in the 1,000 range. It still has not really dramatically taken off, but it is increasing.
Thank you.
And then the funding is provided, just to follow up, the funding is provided from the state?
It's tax credits, so yes, it's state funding.
Members, I think I may have neglected to mention, although it's clearly on the agenda, that we did want to allocate, he said he needed 10 or 15 minutes at the end of the presentations today to hear from Philip Musig from the MPCA about the Sustainable Communities Program, and we should have time to do that, but I think what we want to do now, Mr. Kaufman, is to have you go ahead and describe what you want to tell us about the Portland Task Force in particular.
Okay.
Thank you again. I just wanted to make one side comment that came up in Daniel's presentation and then in one of the questions, which is, Portland and Oregon are often looked to, you know, as being fairly progressive, which, you know, which they are. We've done a lot of things to be proud of. We still have quite a ways to go. But the one thing that really came across, and he was saying that, that never really quite dawned on me in relation to this, is we started doing those things 30 years ago. The land use bill that Representative Kalin just asked about was passed in 1973. The Oregon Department of Energy, where I work, was set up in 1975. We've had these programs going. We developed these programs back in the last energy crisis and had the foresight, perhaps, to continue them. The light rail system was passed, you know, was developed. They started building the light rail system in Oregon in 1986, I think it was. You know, that now, you know, at the time, there was a lot of resistance to it. You know, oh, you know, who's going to use it, this, that. And now, I mean, in the last year or two, the ridership is, you know, has grown 50%. And people are really glad that it's there. So, but these are things that, you know, you're turning a tanker. You know, it takes a long time to do these things. You don't get them in place like that. You know, we have some of the urban, you know, the smart growth policies because we've been doing them for 30 years. They're not going to have the impact if you just try to all of a sudden the crisis happens and think you can do it overnight. It takes a while to get those things happening. Okay, what I was going to do here, run through real quickly what we did with the City of Portland on their peak oil task force report. City of Portland, City Council, they were approached by a citizens group in May of 2006. They said peak oil is a major problem. We'd like the city to do something. The City Council, in its wisdom, looked at it. They actually had a couple of people on the task force that were actually somewhat familiar with the issue, and they said, you bet we should look at it. So they agreed. They passed a resolution and recruited members. They got a 12-member task force, and the 12-member task force, you know, represented a cross-section of the community. One or two I want to particularly point out is the chair of the task force was the former director of the State Economic Development Department, and we had another director of a former director of the State Land Use Department on the task force as well. And these are people that in their own time, as citizens, since they've retired or taken other employments, have realized that, you know, this is a big issue, and when they saw this task force being formed, they wanted to be on it. But it's a group, you know, that I think has some credibility. Set some ground rules when we established the task force. There's no debate about if it's going to happen. We accept. There's no debate about if or when. We accept that the peak is inevitable. It's going to happen. As I said in the previous presentation, there's no magic bullet supply alternative. If you think there's a magic supply alternative, why are you here at the table? And thirdly is we're going to look at the impact first and then the recommendations. And the reason for that is, you know, we walked into the very first meeting of the task force, and they started, some of the members started throwing recommendations on the table already. And we said, wait a second. Don't you think you should identify what the impacts or vulnerabilities are first so that the recommendations might have the effect you want them to have? Or that they address some problems that we have out there? You don't want problems without a recommendation and recommendations without a problem. You need to have them match together. So look at the impact first. And I would suggest if Minnesota were to go ahead and do something, you know, you'd probably want to look at what are the impacts, whether it be a local community or at the state level, look at what those impacts are going to be. Then you can go on to your solution. We will skip that. Impact pathways that we identified, obviously you start with supply shortfalls, some kind of supply problem. And we're talking, of course, oil and natural gas. That, of course, leads to price increases that we talked about. In particular, the sectors that are going to be hit are transportation, manufacturing, and food. Those are the three main areas. I mean, it's going to hit other areas, but those are the main ones in terms of the economy. And I just want to make a side comment there. Food is a major one. 17% of the energy used in this country is used in the food sector somehow, somewhere along the line. It's quite a significant portion. Okay, then from price increases, obviously there's economic impact. There will be less consumer spending. There could be business failures and, in particular, hardship for most vulnerable populations. And that could, in turn, lead to social impact. And on the positive side, there should be some opportunities in there as well, opportunities for efficient businesses, businesses that provide efficient services and stuff. We divided into four subgroups. One of the first questions we were asked was, how do we get our arms around this? You know, they looked at it and said, and they started talking about it, it's like energy affects everything. Everything we do You know, you can't mention something. Everything we make, I mean, half the stuff in this room is made from petroleum products. Anyway, it affects energy, everything. So how do you deal with it? So we broke into four subcommittees, one dealing with land use and transportation because they're so integrated, one dealing with the economy, one dealing with food and agriculture in particular, and one dealing with public and social services. What I'll go through real quickly here is for each task force, what they did, and go through the questions, the key relevant questions under each of those areas that need to be asked, and then what some of the impacts would be. Then from there I'll go on to the recommendations. Key impacts for transportation and land use are: how is freight going to move? How are we going to distribute goods? How will they get to market? And secondly, how will people get to work? And I think Daniel raised that before. Critical issue. If we're going to maintain economic activity, those two things have to happen. They need to get back and forth. Then there's obviously related questions for land use. How is land use going to be affected? And conversely, how can you use land use to address the problem? Impacts, I think, are fairly, you know, reasonably obvious, at least initially. There's going to be, you know, reduced automobility. There's going to be a high demand for alternative transportation. People and businesses may relocate. There will be increased demand, you know, increased demand for density and mixed use. Freight costs will go up, and shifts of moving things are going to change. Air and truck will probably decline. There will be more stuff moved by rail and boat. So we probably need to be looking at doing something to our rail system. Key questions for agriculture is: what happens to the availability and prices of food? And what about food production, processing, transportation, distribution? Will we have enough to do that stuff? The impact, and again, I mentioned agriculture, food and agriculture account for 17% of the energy we use in the country. You know, everything from fertilizers, pesticides, tractors on the field, food processing, distribution to market, people coming to pick up their food, taking it home, cooking it, then disposing of it afterwards, you know, moving water. I mean, it's 17% of our economy is involved in the different sectors. So you're going to see higher food prices. As oil and gas prices increase, it is going to cost more for food. The amount and the variety of food will probably change. It will probably decrease. It's going to be hard to get strawberries from Chile in January. And that's a couple of smaller related impacts there. I won't go through everyone. For businesses and economy, this is a critical one. We tried to engage a lot of businesses in the process. We invited businesses to the table. We were turned down, actually, by a surprising number of them. It was disappointing. The reason why was they said, energy is just a small percent of my business, you know, 2% of my cost. You know, I don't care. You know, even if prices double, I can handle it. And we tried to say, hello, what? There's more than just your production cost. Will there even be a consumer demand for your product? And that's going to be, you know, if there's less discretionary income, if prices are rising across the board, if people are losing their jobs, they're paying more for heating their house and paying more for gasoline and things like that, they're going to have less discretionary income. If the product you're selling is discretionary, you may need to rethink your business model. Are there reasonable substitutes for the product? If there are reasonable substitutes, you may need to rethink your model. You know, if it's the only thing they can have, well, you might wind up being okay and weathering it okay. And the other question you need to ask is, how will upstream supplies be affected? Am I going to be able to get the product that I need from my suppliers at a reasonable price, on time, or in the quantities that I need? How are they going to be affected? Don't just look at your own little pod here, sitting here making, I make this product. You're dependent upon other people. How are they going to affect it? There's a whole supply chain here. And so we tried to engage businesses on that level, but we couldn't get, most of them we could not get to the table. We just looked at their own production costs. So critical one, though, because it will be affected. What will the impact be? Comment we used is it's going to be the 1970s on steroids. For those of you who went through the 1970s, we faced a lot of issues like unemployment, inflation, and recession. We will see that again. And it will be persistent. It will not go away. As oil and gas decline at a couple of percent per year, it will just be a persistent problem. And the thing is, we're not even going to recognize it. We're going to recognize it as an economic problem. We're going to recognize it as inflation and recession. We're going to throw the same old solutions at it, and they're not going to work. Just like they didn't work very well in the 1970s, if you remember. You know, until oil and gas prices started to go down, then we started to climb out of it. So we're not even going to recognize we're going to throw the same solutions at it. We need to rethink that model a little bit. Let's talk about those already. I'll leave the traded sector go. Key questions, or would you like me to cover that?
Right ahead.
Go ahead. Key questions for Public and Social Services Committee is how is the demand for services going to be affected, and how will the ability to provide those services be affected? Supply and demand. And we looked across the board at a number of different sectors there. We invited people in. We're basically representing all those people. I mean, we called the school district. We called, you know, we talked to medical profession. We talked to public health workers. We talked to, I don't know if back there. I can look right up here. We talked to the utilities. We got the water department in. We talked to a wide range of people trying to get their input on it. Probably the biggest impact that we identified in the whole study was, first and foremost, the vulnerable and marginalized populations. The low income, the unemployed, the underemployed, the infirm, the disabled, the elderly are going to be hit first, and they're going to be hit hardest. Others, with more generous means, will be able to absorb some of the costs, find some alternatives, make some adjustments, and at least in the initial phases, you know, we'll probably get by okay. You know, they'll change their lifestyle, but they aren't going to be kicked out on the street or be left without medicine. Those are the people we need to pay attention to. That is probably one of the biggest impacts we are going to see, and that is, as I say, it's going to hit us first. That's one of the first things we're going to see. It is going to stretch already stressed systems. We already have a healthcare system that is under crisis, and this is only going to aggravate it. The demand for services is going to go up. And meanwhile, if unemployment, you know, if there's increased unemployment, the revenues to provide those services will go down. How are we going to meet those needs? And several of the charitable organizations we talked to said the same thing. They said, you know, in tight times, you know, when there's inflation or unemployment, they tend to get, you know, fewer charitable contributions to provide services from that end as well. Impacts are across the board in all the sectors. There could be reduced health coverage, and there will be less preventative care. What's going to wind up happening, as prices go up, we currently have an employer-based health care system. It's primarily employer-based. Most people get their health care through the employer. As the economy starts to suffer a little bit, profit margins are shrunk. One of the things that businesses are going to look at doing is cutting health benefits. So there are going to be people with either less health benefits or no health benefits. To the extent there are people with less benefits or less health benefits, you're going to wind up turning for, you know, doing less preventive care, and that's going to wind up meaning that problems are going to surface on the emergency end of it. There's a direct change, folks, from beginning to end. Problems don't go away, they just shift from one place to another. And we need to be prepared for that across the board. Same thing goes for housing, homelessness, heating, whatever. So, recommendations. Okay, I guess I covered all four task forces. That was good. Recommendations. I've given enough of a gloomy story both with the first presentation I had and this one, so now I'll turn to some of the recommendations. Daniel already touched some of them, but I want to probably get into a little bit more detail on a few of them. We have two pillars of our recommendations, two main things. Number one, we need to reduce our exposure to those vulnerabilities. We need to start preparing now, build in the resilience that Daniel talked about. We need to be resilient and reduce that exposure. Secondly, we need to strengthen community. We are in this together. And one of the solutions is going to be people working together. They're going to have to support each other, help each other out, work together, be creative. That's our foundation. If we don't have that as our foundation, we aren't going to make it through this very well. First recommendation really isn't a recommendation, it's a goal. And it may not even be a goal, it may be a reality. It may be something that everybody faces. We set the goal at 50% reduction over 25 years based on the presumption, which could be wrong, that oil use will probably decline at 2 to 2.5% per year. Now, we will be lucky if the peak happens in, you know, if the decline starts in 10 years from now. We'll be lucky because maybe we'll have a 5 or 10 year jump. But otherwise, everyone's going to go through this. Everyone, once the peak really hits and starts to decline, is going to have to be reducing their energy 50% in 20 to 25 years. Okay, it may be reality and not a goal. Other recommendations? Second recommendation is we need to inform the citizenry. We need to get out and build awareness of this issue, talk to people. Government is not going to be the solution. We're part of the solution, but we're not the only solution. People are going to have to grasp this issue by themselves. Everybody has to lend a hand. There are going to be individual solutions. There are going to be business solutions. There's going to be solutions at the local government. There's going to be solutions at state government level. There's going to be solutions, yes, indeed, even at the federal government. There are some things they need to do, too. And we are going to need to work at all levels, but we need to start by building awareness. Nothing's going to happen until people wake up and realize that we have an issue here that we need to deal with. We need to mobilize their creativity, and we need to integrate this message with other efforts, such as, you know, working with global warming. Thirdly, we need to engage the civic leadership. Same issues that I talked about, you know, we need to educate them, but we need to get to the decision makers, not just to the individuals anymore, but we need to get to the decision makers. You know, the people like you. We need to get out, talk to you guys, across the board, to other states, to local governments, everywhere. They need to be educated. We also need to talk to the business leaders. You know, so we need a bottom-up approach, you know, inform people from the bottom, you know, at the individual level. We need a top-down approach to effective decision-makers, you know, those who are making a lot of the decisions. And if we approach the problem from both ends, maybe we can get there. Land use patterns. We need to change our land use patterns. And again, Portland has already, you know, got a jump on it, but we are far from where we need to be. Portland still, you know, is a big city. It still has its level of sprawl, and it is probably headed, well, it's got its level of sprawl as well as anybody else. We need to reduce our transportation needs. First and foremost, one of the biggest issues. And the city of Portland passed a global warming plan back in 1993, and they have been implementing some of the things, and their carbon emissions are currently at 1990 levels. They have held flat for the last 15 years with their carbon emissions. Now, they still need to go down, but that is still way ahead of everybody else. And I was talking to the lead people at staff, city staff the other day, and they said the reason for it, number one, is this. Public transit that they put in, the light rail system, and the land use patterns, the smart growth that we talked about, the urban villages, that is the driver. That is the foundation. Yes, they have done other things. They have encouraged, you know, renewables. They have encouraged installation, stuff like that. But this is the foundation. You need to provide walkability. Make it accessible for people to use public transportation. Make it safe for them to use bicycles to walk places. You need to provide the accessibility, and you do that by bringing things closer together and providing mixed use. We need smart infrastructure investments. And that's a twofold thing. One is what we do invest in, and two is what we don't invest in. Don't invest, or at least reconsider or rethink very carefully, investments in additional new highways, new lanes, or, in the case of Portland, a new runway on the airport and a new wing on the airport terminal. These are businesses that probably don't have a very rosy future. And do we want to be spending $3 billion on the airport at a time like this? But then there's also what do we invest in, and we've got there, you know, things like we need to be investing, taking some of that money instead, investing in things like a light rail or a trolley system, things that have infrastructure costs. You need to get the jump on things. You aren't going to, that's a 10-year project. You don't get that in. You don't decide, oh, oil prices are high, maybe we should do something, or people can't get to work. Let's go out tomorrow and build a light rail system. You need to be thinking of that way ahead of time and getting the ball moving. Number six is encourage efficient and renewable transportation choices. need to get people out of their cars and ensure that the alternatives are safe and convenient. Whether it be bicycling, we need to find, you know, room on our road for those vehicles on the right, you know, for the neighborhood electric vehicles and other things like that. Make it safe for them. You know, whether it be special lanes or anything else, but those can be very efficient ways for people to get around. Even for bicycling, and I have a picture there. Can't go there. Number seven, expand energy efficiency programs. We need to dramatically, and I mean dramatically, ramp up our existing programs. And again, Portland and Oregon is a leader. I mean, we are you know, trumpeted, you know, nationwide as being, you know, probably the most progressive state in terms of energy and energy efficiency. I've worked there for 25 years. I'm proud of a lot of what I've done. You know, we have the best efficient, you know, most efficient building codes in the country. We've had tax credits in place for a number of years to get things done. We've done the light rail. We need to expand it, but we've got it. We've done a lot of things in Portland and Oregon, and we have barely touched the surface. You know, when I say ramp up programs, I don't mean ramp them up a little. I mean, we need to make a massive effort, a massive investment, and the sooner we get started, the better we will be. Number eight, we need to preserve, there are 11 of them, so you don't think there's 50 of them here, we have 11. Number eight is we need to preserve our local food production capability. Critical, it's because, again, it's going to be more difficult to import foods from different areas, especially by air travel and by truck. We'll probably be able to get some stuff by rail, but that is not going to be the fresh goods or the refrigerated goods. And we'll probably have to start producing more stuff locally. So we need to preserve that farmland. We may want it and need it. You know, get things close to us. More on local food capability, smaller related issues, but things like, you know, promote urban gardening, CSAs, you know, the community supported agriculture, the farmers markets, educate people. Ninth is promote sustainable business opportunities. And sustainable business opportunities, the obvious ones, I think, are the, you know, anything dealing with energy efficiency and renewable energy products and services. I'm sure there will be other opportunities that arise. I mean, clearly, again, within the Portland area, there are some companies in the transportation sector that provide products for the trucking industry or some other industries that probably don't have a very productive future, and there are others that provide that build rail cars and things like that, that you might say that might not be a bad place to be. Those are the businesses we need to be promoting. And along with it goes workforce retraining. Number 10, we need to preserve the safety net, protect our vulnerable populations. We need to maintain a sense of community across the board that I talked about and maintain the basic services so that people can get through this. And number 11, we need to develop emergency plans. And we need to have plans in general, but I'm talking here specifically, we need to have emergency plans in place. What do we do when the price of oil, per the question we had over here before, what do we do when the price of oil does spike to $6 a barrel? Or, not barrel, a gallon. The price of gasoline goes to $6 a gallon or $10 a gallon. You know, we can probably deal with the, you know, spike up to $3.50 or $4, but what happens if it really spikes? You know, who's going to get the oil? Or if there's a shortfall, there's a real cutoff, you know, something really happens in Saudi Arabia or Iraq, and there's a big cutoff. You know, there's a 10% or 20% drop in world supplies overnight. Who's going to get the oil? How are we going to get food to people? How are we going to move water? How are we going to get police and fire and medical services provided? How much is going to go to the agriculture sector? How much is going to go to somebody driving to the movie that night? We need to make those choices. These are not pleasant choices to face. These are not pleasant choices, but we're going to have to do that. And we need to be starting to think about those things. Question comes up often, what has Portland done with the report? And I will run through a couple of slides here. I think I have four more slides. I might have five. I want to run through what Portland has done, what Oregon has done on energy and global warming. On implementation of the Portland plan so far, this was passed last spring, last March, I believe it was. So you've had less than a year. They have already added peak oil as a consideration to their visioning report, which is really, this is looking out 40 years. This is something in saying, what do we want the city of Portland to be like in 20, 30, 40 years? It's a vision. It's not a plan. It's not an implementation on the ground plan. It's a vision. But they're saying, what do we want it to look like? And they've integrated peak oil into that as one of the key drivers that is going to affect what the city will indeed look like 30 or 40 years from now. The second is, and they've also added it to their comprehensive plan, which is, I say, the more immediate day-to-day or month-to-month or year-to-year plan that they've got. They have given dollars to the Portland Department of Transportation and to, I don't know which other city agency it was, to integrate peak oil considerations into the into their plans, into the food policy plan and the Portland Department of Transportation plan. They have adopted renewable fuel standards requiring D5 within city limits now and D10, biodiesel, 10% biodiesel by 2010. The city fleet is D50 today, and the Water Bureau, by their own choice, is at B99 also. Now, I know B99 probably does not work here in Minnesota because of the temperatures, at least at this point. I know that you can't run the biodiesel at 100% biodiesel because of the temperatures, I understand, that you would have here. It needs to be cut somewhat. So. And lastly, they have a green building proposal, fee dates for new buildings. To get homes built beyond the state building code, which already is the most energy efficient building code in the state in the country, but they're looking at going beyond that by providing fee base, charging people if they don't go to 20% beyond the code, and giving rebates and using that money and giving rebates to the people who do go 20% beyond the code. And for existing homes, have a performance rating at the time of sale, which I mentioned before. They tried that once before, about 20 years ago, but I think they're thinking about trying that again. And upgrading commercial lighting by a date certain. Oregon, what have we done? We've had an Oregon Department of Energy since 1976. We have building codes in place that are the most energy efficient in the country. They are 15% beyond what is recommended in the national model codes. We adopted renewable portfolio standard, which I know Minnesota has, and Oregon's is equivalent to Minnesota's, which is really about the best in the country, requiring 25% renewables by the year 2025, and we have it phased in, 10 by 10, 15 by 15, 20 by 20, and 25 by 25. We have a 3% public purpose charge assessed on the utilities that goes towards an organization, a nonprofit organization that was set up called the Energy Trust of Oregon. They use that money then to provide energy programs, get homes insulated. I mean, basically running a lot of utility programs, but it's at a 3% level. I mean, they really ramped it up and got it out of the hands of the utilities into somebody whose sole purpose is providing energy efficiency services across the board to residences, businesses, and industry. We've had tax credits in place for a number of years. 35% tax credit, business tax credit for energy efficiency, 50% for renewables, and 50% for renewable energy manufacturing. We require state buildings, new state buildings to be built 20% beyond ASHRAE standards, and existing buildings have to reduce energy use 20% below year 2001 levels. And the last session, we also passed a bill that requires 1.5% of a construction contract for a public building to be spent on solar energy. I think in the interest of going on, I will cut it short there. I will not go through the global warming issues, and I've already covered these. So let's just call it a day and take any questions.
Are there questions? Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here. This is one of my favorite parts of the country. I love the Pacific Northwest. I have a question about the City Council has this Portland Peak Oil Task Force, but you have, as a state, you have the Department of Energy. Have you, I'm going to ramble for a little bit. I'll try to get to my question. You have a slide that says energy affects everything, and we are learning that, obviously, that it does impact everything. have you been successful in getting the different committees? And I don't know what your legislature setup is like, but are they thinking about these principles when they're going through the committee process in general, when they're debating health policy and housing and agriculture?
Which principles?
Just all the different principles, the things to the planning, the preserve local food production capability. Is this kind of a mindset in the background? Is energy in the background of all the discussions, I guess, is what I'm trying to get to. And if so, how are you able to achieve that?
Mr. Clark, Representative Hilty, Representative Root. Yes, and the answer, I think, is yes and no. Yes, for the City of Portland. Again, this is the City of Portland's report. And as I indicated, they've already, you know, incorporated into their visioning plan, their comp plan, you know, they've given money to the Department of Transportation to incorporate it. So at the City of Portland level, yes, I'd say that is happening because of those examples. No, it is not happening at the state level directly to these points. But at the state level, I mean, it is happening to some extent, like I say, not directly on these points, but Oregon has really, I ran through there a number of the programs that we have developed, and Oregon has, it made the choice many years ago by setting up the Department of Energy where I wind up working. And in retrospect, and they kept it through the years, you know, where energy prices were low, some other states got rid of their energy offices and we kept ours. And I think it was a conscious choice. I mean, they realized that, you know, energy is still an issue, maybe not an immediate crisis, but they wanted to deal with it. And they've kind of kept things going all during the years, and now it's kind of picking up again. Last session, last year, legislature met from January through June, and energy was one of the governor's two or three priorities. You know, we passed about six or seven pretty big energy bills as a result of that.
Further questions? Representative Hausman.
Was it partisan in your state? Was it partisan in your state?
In terms of
the whole issue, the whole broad issue?
Pretty much. Yes. Yes. I mean, surprisingly, I don't know, but I would say that we have a Democratic governor, and so it was his initiative, but we have had a broad support for energy issues for our department and for energy issues across the board for 25 years. I mean, it's nothing new. And why that is, because I don't think that that's the case in a lot of other places, but in Oregon, and that's not to say they don't fight over other issues. I mean, it's actually quite bitter and partisan at times, but not over the energy issue. Over the energy issue, they have really come together pretty much, you know, consistently over the years, not just something new. And I guess I attribute that. I mean, Oregon is kind of a green state or environmental state. And, we have a lot of natural beauty, and I think people are proud of it and want to preserve that. And energy is, a natural resource-related issue, of course. And I suspect it's related something to that.
Representative.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. I just I couldn't resist that, maybe to put a plug in for my bill that I put in last year to create the Department of Energy. So I'm hoping everyone here will support that.
Are there further questions? Seeing none, gentlemen, thank you very much. I see we do have the time that we hope to give Mr. Musig and the Sustainable Communities Program. So, again, thank you, and we really appreciate your willingness not only to be here and talk with us today, but to undertake the rest of the presentations that we have scheduled. I have to apologize publicly for the grueling schedule, but we're going to do it.
If I may, I'd like to thank you for inviting us. I would like to thank everybody for coming. And I mean, I think this is a critical issue. I really want to encourage you to, to take it seriously and start, start seeing what you can do and to work together and do something on this.
But Minnesota is leading on this just by having us here. There have been a handful of other states talking about it, but you're definitely in the lead at this point.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I hope that next time we come, we'll maybe have some other artwork. The artwork in here has the coal-burning power plants, and maybe we'll have windmills and some fields of switchgrass.
Good point. We'll see what we can do about that, Representative Ruth. Mr. Musig, welcome to the committee.
Representative Healthy, Representative Hilstra, members of the committee, thank you very much for having me here. I can switch my glasses from my here. I'll maybe be able to see what I'm reading. So, so I'll make my comments brief. I know you all have to travel up to Duluth. So I'm Philip Musig with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and my colleague.
Rebecca Walter as legislative liaison. And Mr. Chair, you shouldn't speed going up to Duluth because you wouldn't get optimal fuel efficiency out of your car.
Thank you. I always keep that in mind.
excellent. So I come from the Prevention and Assistance Division, a newer division at the MPCA, which incorporates some of members of the old Office of Environmental Assistance. You all may know the OEA. And our team, the work that we've done over the last 10 years is very explicitly a sustainable communities team. We were chartered during the mid-90s during the discussions and the adoption by the legislature of a sustainable development ordinance and language for the nine of us, and we have specialists in eco-industrial development, green building, low-impact developments, sort of water issues, and living sort of green living strategies, behavior change strategies for citizens. So as I say, we've been working for 10 years on energy and certainly more recently with on climate issues, and the in the last year very intensely talking with mayors, city council members, city planners about how climate change and concerns about energy uncertainty are affecting them, what they're thinking about. Many of us from our team come from the pollution prevention world. In 1990, the legislature passed the Toxic Pollution Prevention Act, and so a number of us worked with those 430 large manufacturers in Minnesota on preventing their release of toxic emissions, and that work certainly prevented the need for a hazardous waste incinerator. That was one of the drivers, challenges posed by the federal government in the mid-80s. But so from our world, we see use of materials, we see pollution as an opportunity, opportunity for reduction, certainly, but for innovation. And here are just a couple of recent facts I pulled out. Sort of the frame within which we work is that we're always working on projects that have environmental, social, and economic benefits. So we're very explicitly talking about improving water quality, decreasing costs to local government for water infrastructure, decreasing energy costs for citizens, decreased traffic, opening up transportation options, preserving land. We're looking at sort of not first costs, but long-term costs, total costs, and lowering those, and certainly looking at energy, not just the dollar costs, but energy costs of proposals. To say we come from this preventive world, and in terms of sort of as we look at uncertainty, we take a precautionary sort of a risk management point of view. That when we're unclear about how to proceed, we look we'll err on the side of longer term, more sure outcomes rather than risk. And we were just recently working with a solar hot air manufacturer who was considering using fiberglass, painted fiberglass, and we thought that it would be unwise to proceed, even though these are being certified, sort of the uncertainty over having air flow over the years through a hot air a device with fiberglass seemed not to be the way to go. So we do take this precautionary approach. And the topics we work on, we heard about some of these, and these are sort of bread and butter issues for people working in sustainability. More formally, we sort of work under a couple of nexts here. We sort of work under one of really two or three sort of major formal sustainability principles used internationally. The natural step was one of them. The next industrial revolution, or cradle-to-cradle principles, look at three things. We, rather than a linear system, we want to look at using materials and either composting them, so sort of biomass, working with compostables, or keeping things in sort of technical nutrient cycles. So cyclical rather than linear, using materials and finding value in what we would want to consider waste material. Relying on current income is using that solar income that comes on the earth rather than storage materials, and really looking at diversity in sort of all the three E sectors, diversity in businesses, the main street that has a mixture of types of businesses, ecosystems that have diversity in materials, and diversity in sort of human systems. And certainly the Next Generation Energy Act, you know, dramatic goals and a real significant milepost for communities to work on. We've talked already with several people who are looking at those, and they're scaling them down to, now what do I need to do in my city? And so we find them fabulous. So I'll go over sort of approaches that we use and give some examples here. These are sort of standard tools that people in certainly local and state government use. We do not work on state policy issues. We're really there assisting with money, with knowledge, information, encouragement. Those local entities in communities, be they businesses, local government, citizen groups, or educational institutions, we're sort of helping them sort of get the most out of their energy and their materials. Fostering collaboration is sort of a standard, sort of part of the work, and really sort of uses all that we do. As I say, for 10 years we've been working with and promoting concept of sustainable communities. We've put out an electronic newsletter, monthly newsletter. It's our website. We flashed out at the beginning. It's nextsteps.state.mn.us. And that newsletter presents new resources, manuals, guides, studies, money available, jobs, 3,000 sustainability professionals in the state of Minnesota. Read that. We have a website that catalogs all that information that comes out. In the 90s, we held conferences mainly for industrial businesses on pollution prevention. We always had a sort of how does that business fit in with local government and citizens. We did a series of sustainable communities conferences up in, through 2002, and these were typically very well received, 500, 600, 700 people. We had not done anything until this year. We've been talking, as I said, with mayors, specifically those mayors and cities or city councils that signed the U.S. Mayor's Climate Protection Agreement, talking with them about climate change issues, energy uncertainty, and how that sort of resonates and fits with them. And we decided to do two things this year. We did the first conference in June 2007, where we had Daniel Lurch's colleague Ashley Kim and spoke. We had the environmental commissioner from Ontario speak, J. Grace Hamilton speaking on climate change. So we were very explicitly addressing energy issues, peak oil, and climate change. Very well received, better frankly than we thought it would be. 350 people, majority from local government, which was our target. From that group, we invited people to come to a much more focused half-day session in November, where we had cities that are starting to measure their carbon footprint, are starting to prioritize now, where do we start if we want to decrease our carbon footprint and our energy use? Where do we start? So we had cities talk about what they're doing. We talked about some assistance opportunities. So we had 65 people, and that group is going to meet tomorrow to hear Don Kaufman and Daniel Lurch. So they meet tomorrow. Other events we're doing this year, either we've been active in the development of these vendors, or we're co-sponsoring financially a conference in March that will pull together citizen teams from metro cities that are working on water quality issues, energy issues, transportation, land use, local food. and business development. The Minnehaha Watershed, Minnehaha Watershed District is going to hold also in March a more technical conference, which we're co-sponsoring. The Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, working with the Arrowhead Regional Development Commission, is planning to do a mayor's forum. They've done a preliminary meeting, and this is a group that does want to talk, again, explicitly about energy and climate issues and how they fit together. we have, through some grant work and co-sponsoring, an afternoon session on ordinance development, working with CR Planning. Minnesota Green Communities is sort of the largest funder of affordable green housing in Minnesota. They have what's now an annual conference in May, and so we're supporting them active on their agenda. And then what we've heard most from cities is, well, if we have this target to decrease our carbon emissions, how do we count? What is the metric? What software do we use? So we're anticipating with several other partners, probably the International Council of Local Environmental Initiatives and Fresh Energy and the NCCA, bringing experts who will help cities understand, you know, do I use the ICLEI software, do I use the climate registry software, what's this multi-state Midwest group I hear about. Sort of dealing with those issues is really quite important. So jumping to our another tool here, technical assistance. We see that for some cities, they just need a little help with nitty-gritty problems like, all right, so I do want to figure out how much, you know, fuel my various fleets are using in my parks departments, libraries, so how do we track that? So we jumped off from a program, the Retired Engineers Technical Assistance Program, an existing program that the OEA created, and we created a climate change corps. So we have at this point 8 retired professionals, technical specialties, also specialties in city governance, and those specialists are working in cities as diverse as Milan, Minnesota, South of Morris, Dakota County, Burnsville, Lake City. Other programs, buildings, D3 building benchmarks and beyond, technical assistance for cities that use state bonding, well, anybody who uses state bonding money to build a building, in any civic building over 5,000 square feet, needs to register their energy use, and in comparing energy use of buildings within a city, within statewide, you pick off the low performers, and so we technical assistance is available through the University's Center for Sustainable Building Research, the State Architect's Office, and the White Group who helps manage this D3 database, and the White Group who helps manage this D3 database. So far, we're seeing some significant use of that. The City of St. Paul has a $1 million internal loan fund to help manage the buildings that are the lowest performing to upgrade their energy efficiency. MINTAP, Minnesota Technical Assistance Program, formed in the late 80s, based at the University of Minnesota. We use them, encourage cities, especially use them for their businesses, especially industrial businesses, for energy and waste pollution prevention. Minnesota WasteWise, a program we are active in creating with the Minnesota Chamber, focuses on commercial businesses. And then for citizens and for public education, the Living Green Expo, now coming into its 7th year in 2008, a showcase of products, services, approaches for individuals to sort of live a more sustainable life. We had 23,000 people at this two-day event held in May each year. We were the one of the creators of that and managed that, and the Eco Experience in its second, coming into its 3rd year at the Progress Center. This is a 25,000 square feet of showcasing innovations and Minnesota organizations, businesses working in the areas of local organic food, energy efficiency, and transportation. Quick going over a few slides on financial assistance, sort of past successes, Hanover stands out as work that we're doing on conservation designs, this cluster of rural development, working with the city of Hanover and several private sector firms who have a design about the Crow River where we keep all the stormwater on site, provide more open space and usable open space for this roughly 280 acres. Very explicitly, this is a design that looks at orientation and solar passive solar heating to decrease energy costs for residents, spaces for passive recreation for keeping stormwater, but also looking ahead to putting up a solar turbine that would power this development and also grow energy crops. And we've had over 30 cities interested in looking at this development work with by a conservation developer in the city. A car sharing business that we helped form, we pulled together the initial partners, business that we hope will break even in 5 years, 500 members sharing 16 cars at 15 different hubs, decreasing vehicle miles traveled and taking 120 cars off the road. Rural Renewable Energy Alliance, another first for Minnesota. This is the most advanced solar hot air panel being manufactured up in Backus, Minnesota. And the focus here is all that money, somewhere around $70 million that comes into the LEHAP program, Low Income Heating Assistance Program. We want to see that money go for putting in hot air panels for low-income people who then can save anywhere from 25% to 50% of their annual heating bill on their LEHAP payment, save that off by using these panels. And then Hobbinsfield Farm, you've probably heard about from Jonathan and Marsha, who we worked at putting together the financing package for the for Minnesota's sort of modern, I mean, digesters have been around certainly back before the Depression, but sort of a modern manure digester which produces enough heat and energy to run the farm as 1,000 cows, family farm with Jonathan, their sons and daughter, saving, well, producing enough electricity also for about 75 homes around the Princeton farm, and also earning money over $2,000 a year by reselling the carbon credits to ultimately the carbon climate exchange. Current projects that we're working on, a certification, a third-party system with the building, Builders Association of Twin Cities, Minnesota Green Star Home, and the Green Institute. We're working rolling this out formally in March. So someone says, you know, I'd like a home that meets some pretty high standards in terms of energy, water efficiency, durability, indoor air quality. How do I know? Well, we have a standard that we're developing. MinDev, the Minnesota Zero Emission Design Tool, working with the University Sustainable Building Sustainable. What do you call it? Center for Sustainable Building Research. They were the ones who created the Minnesota Sustainable Building Design Guideline that is used by those recipients of state bond funds. MinDev tool will be a way for architects, as they're designing a building, to see what's the carbon footprint in dynamic time. So if you add space, change building orientation, use different windows, what's the actual carbon output? LEED for Neighbors Development is a rating system, part of the suite of nationally used leadership in energy environmental design tools, and we're working at the Ford Twin City Auto Assembly Plant, that site, with the City of St. Paul on analysis of this, what will be a rating system rolled out in early 2009. We have a grant to Linden Hills Light and Power. The question came up, what about all that material that we're throwing away? Well, there's opportunity in that. And so Linden Hills Power and Light is investigating systems used in Europe where we take that organic fraction, digest it to produce heat for district heating for a small business node in southwest corner of Minneapolis and then produce electricity. And then working with Minnesota Extension on the economics of just how small how little acreage could a farmer devote to growing canola or soybeans to develop biodiesel to run all the uses on the on their farm. Future projects, the first three we actually just yesterday rolled out on especially targeting those cities that have, or city councils that signed the U.S. Mayor's Climate Protection Agreement, were offering grants of up to $10,000 for city-citizen partnerships work to very explicitly look at energy and climate issues and move forward on sort of whatever issue is most pressing, be it land use for cities, transportation, buildings. We want to sort of, as we've heard from specifically city council members, we want to fuel that citizen energy, people who want to sit on task force and spend a lot of time and do a lot of research and help city council focus their efforts. So that grant round just opened, and so we're encouraging cities to apply. We're also going to be funding what we think will be a group of public and private sector industrial specialists who would look at sites like the Rock 10 recycling plant, Ford plant, industrial development plants out of Medalia, and looking at designing much more high-performing sort of interlocked sets of businesses. We also, through a recommendation going to the legislature from the LCCMR, we have a proposal to assist hundreds of schools as they work on becoming carbon neutral and work toward carbon neutral neutrality in projects that are using students and administrators and parents and school officials. The other three are very preliminary. The proposals to us among many that we receive are relatively tight grant rounds. So the idea, I'm sure many people thought about, is that city program. What if it were a Green Star city program? Again, a certification challenge program. We also have a proposal up in the Lake District to take lead for neighborhood development, that emerging performance standard, and have a performance standard for a design in rural townships and small towns and around the Lake District. And then a permaculture group working with David Tillman, biomass specialist at the University of Minnesota. They're proposing to us to look at rain gardens, which are being very effective. For example, in our Hanover project, we're keeping all the stormwater on that site, that 280-acre site, which will prevent the cost from having to do stormwater and gutters and so forth. But what if there was more careful scientific attention to the plants and the design of the rain gardens to also capture much more carbon? So maybe in conclusion, we really see the challenge of climate change, the issue of peak oil and uncertainties about energy. You know, we see them as opportunities for innovation, and that's just our, kind of what we've been doing. And so we take this attitude, and even if these issues of climate and energy end up being less serious than we think they're going to be, these are things that we want to do anyway. These are sort of the bread and butter of our work on sustainable communities. Historically, in a sense, we've been here before during the two oil shocks between the period of 73 and 83. The United States actually produced a little less CO2, so our carbon footprint as a nation dropped when about 2 or 3% of the world's oil supply was taken off the market. But our economy grew, at least if you use the measure of GDP, you know, our economy did grow between 73 and 83. And even though those were some tough times, especially in 1980, 1973, you know, we were able to sort of power through and become more efficient. And so, you know, we focus on sort of the benefits, the outcomes. What we're hearing from cities is that rethinking business as usual leads to some tremendous improvements in terms of just community design and land use. We're seeing around the country that those more compact, connected, complete communities, either development proposals or new developments, they're performing better. They're not being affected by the mortgage meltdown the way other very, well, particularly various or more expensive spread out developments are. So we see tremendous benefits. These are the outcomes we're aiming for, to build more resilient, sustainable communities. So with that, thank you, Representative Kelsey, Hilton, and members of the committee.
There are brief questions. We have time for one or two. Representative Hausman.
You just referenced Rockspan, and I missed your reference. What you're doing with Rockspan?
We are thinking that we would put together a team, a design team of specialists. We're looking at someone at the University of Minnesota, several people in private practice, a team of industrial development specialists who are looking at eco-industrial development and sort of high-performance industrial systems, and we would make their services available to Rock 10. Because
you're thinking about it, or you're talking to the company about it?
We have talked to the company. We would issue a request for proposals for the specialists to be on this team, and then we have, in the design phase, is a sort of a planning structure, like the Minnesota design team goes out and does this intense Thursday night through Sunday morning design charrettes with community. We're thinking that we'd make the services of the eco-industrial design team available to Rock 10, which is looking at how to supplant their steam feed, and also perhaps provide district heating for the Central Avenue corridor.
Representative Bryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How large is your office, and how many people do you have available to you in these initiatives, and are you prepared to ramp up? What would it take to put that kind of a plan in place?
I've been talking about the work mostly done by 9 people in this sustainable community development team, but we're one of, I mean, actually, you can answer this question better than I. We're obviously one of, in the prevention and assistance division, 100 and...
Yeah, I'm not sure either. We can get back to you. Another 800 in the agency. So, but the prevention assistance division, I couldn't tell you the number.
Yes, there's 800 in the MPCA, but they're not prepared to advance these initiatives. I'm talking. So my question is, what you're doing seems really important and exciting and critical, but very small scale.
Mm-hmm.
And so, are you prepared to ramp up, and do you have a plan in place if it were required in the short term?
I would say the biggest way one of the biggest ways we could ramp up is return to the larger amount of pass-through grant funds that we had. So the Office of Environmental Assistance at one point had probably $1,700,000 to give out in grants. We're down to $360,000, and we see such, you know, creativity and energy out in cities and in public-private partnerships in Minnesota that we would love to be able. We had 2 years ago 150 proposals, and we only funded maybe 20, 30. So we would love to see, that would be a very simple way, to simply get out more money to fund projects like Our Car, which are scalable, definitely, projects to disseminate the work we've done in Hanover.
Representative Hilster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You talked about the cuts that you sustained. Can you tell me who recommended those cuts?
You know, I think that the cut in our grant program has, well, certainly in the old OEA, it was just part of, you know, general tightness in state government. And since we've been merged into the Pollution Control Agency, you know, certainly we've been able to add a staff person or two. And I can't tell you whether grant funds overall they probably have gone up through Clean Water Partnership money, but in our particular assistance division, I think that the problem with grant funds is just reflected in overall tightness, and I couldn't ask you that specifically.
Ms. Walter, did you have anything that you wanted to add before we adjourn?
Mr. Chair, don't see it.
There are no further questions. Mr. Music, I think that your presentation probably inspired a lot of interest, and I'm sorry that we don't really have time to pursue many of the things that members probably did find interesting, but fortunately we know where to find you.
Yes, you do.
Although I might point out that if one goes searching for your program on the website, that it requires a great deal of persistence and diligence in order to find you, and I think maybe that's something you should focus a little of your attention on.
Appreciate it, Dr.
Members, thank you very much for staying through a very long meeting, but I hope everyone found it as useful as I did. The meeting is adjourned.